Okay, good evening all. My name's Dean Winter. I'm the Mayor of Kingborough, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this ordinary meeting of Council on Monday the 29th of January 2020 at 5:30pm, and I officially declare this meeting open. My first role is to remind you that Council's policy is to record its public meetings and make those recordings available on its website. And so in accordance with that policy, I now ask the General Manager to confirm that the audio recording has commenced.
Confirmed.
The General Manager has confirmed that. Acknowledgement of the traditional owners. I'd like to begin tonight by paying our Council's respect to the traditional and original custodians of this land, the Muwinina people. I acknowledge the contemporary Tasmanian Aboriginal community who have survived invasion and dispossession and continue to maintain and fight for their identity, their culture and Indigenous rights. Attendees, this evening we have myself, Councillor Winter, Councillor Westwood, Councillor Bastone, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Fox, Councillor Grace, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Street, Councillor Wass, and from our staff this evening, we have our General Manager, Gary Arnold, our Deputy General Manager, Tony Ferrier, our Chief Financial Officer, John Breen, our Acting Executive Manager of Engineering Services, Darren Johnson, our Executive Manager of Governance and Community Services, Daniel Smee, our Manager of Development Services is Tasha Tyler Moore, our Contracts and Procurement Coordinator is Hugh Rowley, and our Executive Assistant is Amanda Morton. And apologies this evening is Councillor Paula Reet, who's on a leave of absence. Okay, the next item is the confirmation of minutes. Would anyone like to move the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting Number 1 held on 13th of January 2020 be confirmed as a true record? Councillor Fox and seconded by Councillor Midgley. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, the motion is carried unanimously. Just a brief interruption there. The next item, as Councillor Midgley left the room at, what are we at? 5:31pm. Workshops held since the last Council meeting on the 20th of January, we had a workshop on place score. As Councillor Midgley returned to the meeting at 5:31pm. Declarations of interest. Does any councillor have a declaration of interest they'd like to declare this evening? There are no declarations of interest. We move on. Transfer of agenda items. Would any councillor like to transfer an agenda item? Councillor Grace.
Now, I'm just wondering whether or not we can transfer the lease of a boat shed. That's on the page. It's 17.2. Page 140 of our agenda, so if those people want to catch the ferry back to Bruny Island.
That does sound like a reasonable thing if people are here from Bruny Island. Does anyone have an issue with that? I'm just trying to think practically how we can do that. Do you have a view? Where would we move it to, GM?
Move it to the first item.
Before the Planning Authority or...?
After the Planning Authority.
So we'd still go to the Planning Authority. We'd still go to the Planning Authority, so we'd only be moving it up above the notices of motion to... Is that okay? Oh, yeah. You all right?
Yeah. Oh, that's it.
Okay, cool. We're good. Well, it's pretty high up in the open session anyway, after the Planning Authority. We hope we won't be too long tonight. Famous last words. Okay, the next item is the questions without notice from the public. Does any member of the public have a question without notice to ask? If you could start with your name and address, and you probably just need to flick it on. Yes, there.
Thank you. Good evening. Trish Ramsey, Roslyn Avenue. My questions tonight are about North Roslyn Avenue. And firstly, prior to asking the questions, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank those councillors who supported the motion on the 9th of December last to recommend to Department of State Growth that the speed limit on Roslyn Avenue between Beach Road and Ginnebine Road be reduced to 40 kilometres an hour. So on behalf of all the petitioners and their families who look forward to a safer traffic and pedestrian environment on our street, we sincerely appreciate your concerns and actions. Thank you. My questions tonight relate to the December motion. At the last meeting, in the current and ongoing minute resolutions, it was noted that the anticipated date of project completion is listed as June 2020. Can you please explain that time frame? Is it when the council anticipates sending the submission to State Growth?
General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Ramsey, no. It's the anticipated time frame to conclude the matter satisfactorily.
Thank you very much indeed. Can we therefore be copied with Council's submission to State Growth when that goes, when that is sent?
General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Ramsey, that's not normal practice of Council. What I can tell you to answer the question, though, is that under Section 62(1)(b) from memory of the Local Government Act, as your General Manager, I am duty-bound to implement Council resolutions, and I will ensure that the Council resolution is implemented.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions without notice from members of the public?
John Maynard from Flowerpot Crescent in Blackmans Bay. Firstly, I was amused by the Mayor and Deputy Mayor's version of the New Zealand Prime Minister's attempt to fit her government's achievements since coming into office into a 2-minute video. If the Mayor and Deputy Mayor were so impressed with this attempt, I'm wondering what they think about Ms Ardern's 2019-20 budget style, which prioritises as a measurement of its success on the well-being of people rather than just the normal economic factors. This links to another trend, which is the increasing emphasis being placed on how livable suburbs are rather than just concentrating on the basic roads, rates and rubbish, where livability considers a range of factors, not just housing supply and affordability. So my question is, if Council chose to measure its success in livability terms, how well would it score?
Thanks for your question, Mr. Mayhart. I've noted and read the New Zealand budget, the wellbeing budget, and I thought it was really good. I noted that there was discussion in the State Parliament about the state budget moving to using those wellbeing metrics. I'd love to see some of those metrics used at a local government level. In some ways they are, but it's not something that we're planning to do in this budget cycle. With the format, it's not proposed to change our format. We're looking at a very, very difficult budget this year, perhaps even more difficult than last year's budget, and I suspect we'll be focusing more on the numbers than on the format or the structure of it.
Thank you, Mayor. My next question is about expert reports that often accompany development applications and has been prompted by a couple of issues. One is comments from councillors during debates that they seem to have no expertise or authority to question these reports. And my experience during the Mary Knoll case at the Planning Commission last September. In this case, there was a traffic impact assessment, including the application to council. And in the end, it was left to representatives to apply some common sense and basic maths to determine that the traffic movements calculated were unbelievably low and based on unrealistic assumptions. So much so, the report had to be rewritten, with revised traffic movements 70% higher than the initial figures, even though these were based on a guesstimate of the final number of dwellings, which we still don't know. So I'm not suggesting here that all expert reports are inaccurate, but I am suggesting that councillors have an obligation and a responsibility to satisfy themselves that the reports are reasonable, can stand up to scrutiny and they pass the pub test. So, Mayor, my question is, why is it that councillors seem so reluctant to critically analyse expert reports?
Thanks for your question. Councillors aren't reluctant to question reports, and Mary Knoll's a great example of that. The recommended advice on the Mary Knoll PSA was to not initiate the amendment, and the majority of councillors critically analysed that report and decided on balance that they thought it was worth initiating. And I also read the report from the Tasmanian Planning Commission, which seemed to agree that it's on its critical assessment and agreed with a critical analysis of councillors in determining to initiate the Mary Knoll amendment in the first place.
Thank you, Mayor. My last question has also been prompted by the Mary Knoll case, and is particularly the Planning Commission's imposition of permit conditions on the subdivision. The TPC supported submissions put to it by representatives who argued that the proposed development posed a significant risk to the swift parrot population. The TPC imposed design and construction conditions on a number of lots to reduce the swift parrot deaths from collisions with built structures. In this case, the TPC recognised the need to mitigate the risk of this highly endangered species and have acted accordingly. So, Mayor, my question is, why don't councillors see the same need and therefore fulfil their obligations under the planning scheme to protect threatened and endangered species within Kingborough?
I've never heard anyone allege that this council doesn't take its obligations to the environment seriously, like I think you just have. In fact, I think we take these issues more seriously, particularly when it comes to planning, than any other council. In fact, we're renowned for it. The decision of the TPC to provide some amendments, they were only very minor in the scheme of things, and actually the TPC's decision vindicated the initial decision of elected members here in almost every way. So I'm very comfortable with the level of interest and seriousness that we take environmental issues, in particular the habitat, protecting habitat for the swift parrot.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks, Mr. Maynard. Any other questions without notice from the public? In that case, the next item is questions on notice from the public, but there were no questions on notice from the public at the time the agenda was compiled. So I now move to questions without notice from councillors. Councillor Grace.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a question regarding the Norwest Bay River. As council have spent lots of money through grants maintaining the river flow, I looked at the river at Longley yesterday and quite concerned about the debris that's been washed down and the erosion that's caused in that particular area due to the large amount of washdown. My question is, who's responsible for cleaning of that river?
Mr. Ferrier?
Through the chair, the river itself is the administration of the water resources within that river is that of Tipiwi. So they're managing the extraction of water and any use of the river course itself. It would also be most likely Crown land. So again, it would be within the ambit of Tipiwi to look after those sorts of problems.
Further to my question regarding Longley Park, I noted there was some weed, and I'm not a weed expert, but the grounds were mowed quite good, very good in fact. But I noticed these weeds, I don't know whether they're poppies or what they were, but they're obviously a weed. Now, what control is council taking on their own reserves?
Mr. Ferrier? Oh, no, you, do you want to take it on notice? Yeah, so Mr. Ferrier will take it on notice.
Thank you. And my other question is, Mayor, and I've got only two others, sorry. Oyster Cove Hotel. I noticed in the book that in our agenda that there is a question been raised by Councillor Bastone, but my question is a bit different. It's a different question. My question is, Mayor, I can't recall seeing a development application for the construction of a car park being built down there I believe it is what is alleged to by Councillor Bastone's question regarding state growth for offset parking, but still I would like to know where the DA, and was it done under delegation or what?
Mr. Ferrier. For the record, Councillor Westwood left the room at 5:44 and returned at 5:45. Mr. Ferrier.
Through the Chair, there is a response to that question in the agenda. My own personal view is that it's likely to fall under an exemption for emergency works in order to get the vehicles off the main road under the Channel Highway. But that's something which is open to interpretation. There's a bit of a grey area there in relation to how it would be interpreted. In answer to the question more precisely, we have not received a development application for any works. I'm not aware of the extent of the works which have been undertaken, but the area is only used for a few hours on a few days each year, and it's used in order to get the vehicles off the Channel Highway in order for public safety, and it may well fall under the exemption of an emergency works under the planning scheme.
I can't see how it could come under the emergency, because if that's the case, everything should be done under the emergency. This has been a problem down on Ferry Road for 10-15 years. So the question is, Mr. Ferrier, I don't agree that it should comply under emergency, if under emergency situation. So I'd like to hear more about it. I think all councillors will.
So is that a question for now, you mean? Or you,
well, let's get something in writing from
you. So I think Mr. Ferrier has just responded and provided a response. Did you have anything else to add?
No, through the Chair, as I said, it was just a grey area, and it was just my opinion. And I was just expressing that from that perspective. We can look at it more closely and examine the details of the actual circumstances a bit more closely.
Okay, thank you. My last question is, Bruny Island Hotel built units. I can't think of the name. Harvey Street. No, it's not Harvey Street. I can't think of the name.
Ritchie Street.
Sorry?
No, sorry. Keep going. Harvey Road?
Is it Harvey's Road, yeah. There was a subdivision lodged for that particular road some years ago, a subdivision of lots. It was part of that request that the subdivider seal the road up to his subdivision. I understood that the same condition applied to these units that's been built on the same piece of road some 12 months ago, and I've not yet seen any sealing of the road. And I just would like to check to see whether it was part of their condition when they lodged for the units.
Ms. Tyler Moore.
Through you, Mayor, I'd need to look at the conditions of the planning permit, and I'm happy to bring that back to the next meeting.
And just finally, the hotel again. Was the hotel prosecuted, is that the proper word? I'm sorry if I got it wrong, but anyway, for having caravans on the site, and has that been brought to Council's attention? No, it hasn't been brought to Council's attention. Can we have a report on that, please?
Ms. Tyler Moore or Ms. Ferrier?
Through you, Mayor, we can bring some detail back about, I'm assuming, talking about non-compliance with the planning scheme, the use of the caravans at the hotel. We can bring that back to the next meeting as an update.
Thank you. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you, Mayor. My first question is in relation to the report on urban design from the urban design officer, who says that the placement of council-acquired artworks, including from the Birches Bay Farm sculpture trail, are being within the public domain across Kingborough, and they will be shortly installed in the streetscapes adjacent to the Kingborough Hub. I noticed that one of the sculptures has been taken from the waste transfer station, where it has been greatly admired. It is now outside the hub, but I'm more concerned with where is the one that the mayor bought last July, the fish that I haven't been able to find anywhere.
I don't know where it is.
We paid $5,000 for it, so I'd like to know where it is.
Take your advice on the quality of the artwork. Does anyone know, or should we take this on notice? Mr. Smee.
Mayor, I suspect it's still at the Birches Bay Farm, awaiting a location to be determined. But I can find out and provide further information.
So we'll take that on notice then.
And could Mr. Smee, could you let me know if you have in fact already paid for the sculpture?
Mr. Smee will include that in his... We'll also take that on notice.
Thank you. My next question is, at the Middleton Hall, there's a car park, and from the car park there's a path that leads up to the hall. Now, in winter, this is particularly dark, and I'm wondering if the council will be able to see its way clear to putting some sort of lighting on this thing. It's used regularly by the South Channel Garden Club, which has 40 regular attendees and a membership of 140 people, and it's quite dangerous at night because people are getting a bit elderly down that way. Not me, but other people.
Mr. Johnson.
Through you, Mayor, happy to go and investigate that further and look at logistically how we might be able to make that work.
Thank you. And my final question is, what is being done about the paling fence that was erected in the Kettering playground that I've asked the question before? Everybody agreed that it was unsightly and that something would be done. And so what is being done?
Mr. Johnson.
Through you, Mayor. Something is being done with that paling fence. The urban design officer is actually working with the depot to try and come up with a more palatable solution. But it's sort of in with everything else that's on the to-do list, so we're just trying to prioritise to get that work done. But there will be a sensible outcome in place.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor, three questions. The first question is about humanitarian crisis assistance policy. So we've seen recently at Hobart and at Clarence there have been recent debates about sending money into state for bushfire relief. Does this council have an emergency donations policy or humanitarian crisis assistance policy?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, no, we don't. We used to have a budget line item for that purpose, but that no longer exists.
Thank you. Second question, Mayor. This one is about short-term accommodation and the risk of a perceived conflict of interest. The website, it's called Inside Airbnb, and it notes that Kingborough Council area has at least 270 entire homes and apartments listed on Airbnb. And in this last month alone, we've seen nearly 20 dwellings change use from residential to short-stay accommodation. The first part of this question is, what would happen if a motion was to come before this council that sought to alter provisions relating to visitor accommodation that had the intent of curbing the ongoing loss of residential accommodation in Kingborough to short-stay accommodation? Let's say if a councillor or their family owns or operates a property that is used for short-term accommodation, would they be allowed to vote on the matter? Would existing conflict of interest regulations require that any councillor who owns or operates a property that's used for short-term accommodation be required to publicly declare their pecuniary interest in the topic of the motion? And secondly, would they be required to recuse themselves from any debate about short-term accommodation?
General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Councillor Cordova, the requirements under declarations of interest are that in a circumstance such as you've outlined, if a councillor owned a property that was subject to a notice of motion, along those lines, they would be required to declare that interest, and my advice would be that they would leave the room.
And am I right that there is currently no register of members' interests for councillors with respect to short stay accommodation, and would we consider implementing one before any such debate about short term accommodation?
General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. There is currently a register of interest for councillors, and my response, Councillor Cordova, would be that if any councillor currently has a property, investment property, or property of any description that is currently used for Airbnb or any other purpose that might be in conflict with councillors, the councillor's duty as a councillor, that it would already have been declared.
Thank you. And finally...
Ms. Tollemore, did you want to supplement that answer?
Through you, Mayor, I don't have any comments about the conflicts of interest discussion, but it is worth noting that it would have to... it would require changes to the planning scheme, which would have to go through the state government to alter any controls to do with short-stay accommodation, because it is controlled by the planning scheme.
Thanks. Final question, Mayor. This question is about safeguards for good governance. We had a situation last council meeting where a vote was taken, then new information came to hand, and so Section 18 of the Meeting Regulations procedures was invoked to rediscuss the resolved matter. The question is, what safeguards are in place to reduce the risk that information of a critical nature might be deliberately withheld from reports to council, so that if in the event of the council voting in a way that does not please the motion's proponents, the proponent might then introduce new information and invoke Section 18 of the Meeting Procedure Regulations in order to force the rediscussion of a resolved matter and bring on a re-vote, as happened at the last meeting?
As happened in the last meeting? Well, what are you alleging happened in the last meeting?
My question is, what is to stop somebody from deliberately withholding critical information from a report to council in order to use that as an excuse to rediscuss a matter?
Well, it's quite a stretch, but General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Councillor Cordova, firstly, you referenced, I believe, Section 18. It's in fact Section 19, discussion of a resolved matter. It says in part, if new information comes to hand or, in the opinion of the chairperson, the Mayor, some vital information has been overlooked. It then goes on to say a motion that a matter be allowed to be discussed again under this sub-regulation 1 is to be made and voted for in the affirmative before the matter may be discussed. That is what took place at the last council meeting. In answer to your second question, under the legislation, Section 65, in every council agenda, I have to sign, as required by legislation, to say that the professional advice provided by council officers is in fact professional, has full and open disclosure, and nothing is withheld. That's the answer to your question.
Thank you, Mayor. And the follow-up is to broaden that question out to not just the person who's actually proposing the motion, but a motion's proponent. So if somebody... Do you see how it's broader than just council officers' reports to council? It's broader than that. It's about a report... It could be about a report that somebody else asks a councillor to bring before the council and then deliberately withholds information so that they can then use that new information that has come to hand as an excuse to rediscuss the matter. Are there any safeguards in place to prevent that from happening?
Yeah, General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Councillor Cordova, I've outlined in my previous response the legislation requires not only me as the incumbent general manager, but any member of my staff that puts a report to council to do so in accordance with the legislation. In terms of your reference to independent third-party experts, for want of a better term, generally, particularly in planning-related matters, they are members of professional associations that have similar requirements, particularly for consultants to uphold their status as a registered consultant.
Thank you, Mayor.
Councillor Watts.
Thank you, Mayor. I have one question in closed session. And the other question I'd like to ask is,
Can I be informed whether or not the Hobart Huskies Basketball Club have cleared their debt of $3,370 to council? If not, have staff contacted the then club office bearers with regards to debt clearance and what has been the outcome?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, I am not aware that the debt has been settled. I can advise that staff have been in contact with the representatives from the Huskies board requesting the matter be finalised, but to date it has not been.
I forgot. I just want to ask on regarding a question raised about the panel fence at Kettering Football Ground. I'm not quite sure. A, it must have cost money to build it in the first place.
No, it's not at the football ground.
Where is it?
It's on the playground near the cricket ground.
Or near the cricket ground, what I call that. Yeah. So at what cost and who paid for the fence? We need to know that before it's all of a sudden demolished. I believe we should know.
I assume it's out of our existing budget.
Well, Mayor, I drove down there the other day and there's a paling fence being built around a house. Are we going to go down there tomorrow and tell them that's not suitable? I mean, I'd like to know what the fence cost and
so your question is, how much did the fence cost?
Yeah, okay. And the other just simple question, did Tassie Tyres ever pay their fine?
Take it on notice. Ms. Tollemore, right. Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, the fine was not paid by Tassie Tyres because that company went into liquidation. And yes, there are other Tassie Tyres around, but they're registered as separate businesses.
Mr. Mayor, on that, and that's what I felt happened, and I'm very disappointed that some of this stuff does not come before the table, before these people are put into a court, which cost our ratepayers money, and everyone knew, before council even served notice on them, that they were going into liquidation.
Councillor Gross, okay, thank you. Next item is questions on notice from councillors. The first question is from Councillor Grace, and it's about Middleton toilets. Question two is also from Councillor Grace in relation to the Conyngham toilets. Question three is from Councillor Bastone about the record of road clearing. Question four is also from Councillor Bastone on maintenance of verges. Question five, in fact, the next few are from Councillor Bastone. Five is on roadkill. Six is on water restrictions. Seven is on a new road at Bruny Island. Question eight is on a pipeline to Bruny Island. Question nine is on leased land to SeaLink. Question 10 is permits required for dormitory accommodation. Question 11 is from Councillor Westwood and it's in relation to Blackmans Bay toilets. Question 12 is from Councillor Cordova and it's in relation to single-use plastics. Question 13 is from myself and it's about the sale of car park to John Street Medical Centre. Question 14 is also from myself and it's in relation to water quality at Blackmans Bay Beach South. And with that, the open session adjourns and at the time 6:03... and the Planning Authority commences at 6:03, and apologies in advance to those people. I said this might be quick, but it doesn't seem to be going that way. First item is officers' reports to the Planning Authority. There's a recommendation on page 12. Would someone like to move the recommended motion? Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Westwood. Any comments or questions in relation to this report? Councillor Grace.
On page 11, DA 2019-365, amenity blocks, was it a toilet or was it a... it says this is on 152 Channel Highway, Margate. I believe that's the old house that burnt down just a while back, is it or not? What are they building? Amenities block.
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, just for the record of the tape, it's 2019-369, amenities block. It's associated with the essential oils business that operates from that property. The amenities block is toilets and showers for the staff.
Okay, thank you. Just one other on sort of on page 12, the planning for the playground. Obviously, we didn't get any protesters for that, or any written submissions against it. So therefore, it's done under delegate. I bet there's a lot of developers out there wish theirs could go through so smoothly.
Must have been a good application, Councillor Grace. Ms Tollemore, do we have any representations about the playground?
No, Mayor, there were no representations.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I just have a question. DA 2019629, the partial change of use to visitor accommodation. I am just wondering, are there any parking requirements for this change of use? I just note it's a very high busy vehicle area, and do they need to have like parking on site to change to visitor accommodation?
Ms Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, there are requirements for parking for visitors, parking for visitor accommodation use, but the parking rate is the same as residential use, which the application was originally approved for, so the parking requirement's been satisfied. It's the same if it was apartment or visitor accommodation.
Okay, there are no other lights on, in which case the motion is moved by Councillor Midgley and seconded by Councillor Westwood. Is that the report be noted? All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Motion's carried unanimously. Next item is PSA 2019-1, which is application to adjust the zone boundary for environmental management and site-specific amendment to P1 of Clause 14.5.1 at 757 and Lot 3, Channel Highway, Kingston, for all urban planning. There's a recommendation on page 33. Would someone like to move
it? I move it.
Okay, moved by Councillor Grace, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Grace.
Well, I don't think there's a lot to be explained, and there'll probably be more questions asked on the next one.
There are no other lights on, in which case I'm about to close the debate unless someone wants to make a contribution. In that case, the motion as moved by Councillor Grace and seconded by Councillor Midgley is that Council resolves that the report of the Manager Development Services be received and that A, pursuant to Section 34(1)(b) of the Formal Provisions of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993, Council resolved to initiate Amendment PSA 2019-1 of the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015. B, pursuant to Section 35 of the Formal Provisions of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993, Council certified that Amendment PSA 2019-1 to the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015 meets the requirements of Section 32 of the Formal Provisions of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993 and authorised the General Manager to sign the instrument of certification. C, pursuant to Section 56S of the Water and Sewer Industry Act 2008, Council refers Amendment PSA 2019-1 to Taswater. And D, pursuant to Section 38 of the Formal Provisions of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993, Council place Amendment PSA 2019-1 to the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015 on public exhibition for a period of at least 28 days following certification. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Approved unanimously. There the words. Next item is DAS 2019-5, development application for boundary adjustment at Lot 3 in 757 Channel. Is that the same one? Sorry, I've just done that one. No, it's a different one, sorry. And there's a recommendation on page 50. Would anyone like to move or second that recommendation?
I'll move it.
Moved by Councillor Grace. Yeah. Seconded by Councillor Bastone. Councillor Grace.
I don't have a lot to say about it, Mayor. It's pretty straightforward, I think, within the report.
Okay, there being no further comments, the motion was moved by Councillor Grace and seconded by Councillor Bastone, and it's that the Planning Authority resolves that the report of the Manager Development Services be received and that in the event that the Council decides to
to initiate and certify draft amendment PSA 2019-1 under Section 33.3 and Section 35 of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993, retrospectively the development application for a boundary adjustment at Lot 3 and 757 Channel Highway, Kingston, be approved and a draft planning permit granted subject to the following conditions. I'm not going to read them. There are nine of them and they are as printed in the agenda. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, the motion is carried unanimously. We move on. The next item is DA 2019-130, development application for demolition and construction of dwelling at 30 Karingal Court, Taroona, for ERA planning, and there's a recommendation on page 82. Would someone like to move and second? Moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Fox.
Thank you, Mayor. It just seems hard to find my way through this document. I think, looking at the recommendation from staff, the critical issue here is that the experts providing advice that there is landslip risk acknowledge that there is. They want council to take on the responsibility, and they ask that we disclaim them from any liability arising from any assumptions being incorrect, and acknowledge that pragmatically the regular and planning authority should be the determining authority in relation to what constitute an acceptable risk. Now, as far as I'm concerned, if we've been told that there is a landscape, a landslip risk, there are undesirable and unreasonable detrimental impacts on the natural landscape, they don't adequately satisfy the performance criteria in P3 of Clause 12.4.2, and also the performance criterion P1A, B, or 1 of Clause E11.7.1, etc. There are many coastal hazard codes also that are not being met, and the primary reason is that the proposal conflicts with the local area objective of Taroona of the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme, which identifies that existing larger lot sizes are to be retained in order that there is sufficient land to accommodate substantial vegetation on site and provide for the desired landscape and natural amenity, and only minimal expansion of the existing urban footprint permitted. And there is also a clause in here somewhere that says that the there are many geoconservation priority values which are being compromised in the cliff, and that there is an alternative location that this development could be placed away from the cliff, therefore avoiding all of these concerns. So it being so thoroughly contrary to the planning scheme, I would recommend that Council supports this motion to refuse. Thank you.
Councillor Grace.
I speak against this recommendation on the basis that I do know a little bit through my lifetime. In fact, I built Karingal Court, the subdivision. There you go, for the great Max Doyle. That has not slipped in a great manner over the years. I've been quite surprised with the stabilisation of that ground there, and if you look at the size of houses right along the cliff front there, and I look at this one as a demolition of the existing and building a new one, and the way they propose to do it, and with the ground test report, and they're supposed to be experts in this field, I have no problems with them including a 3 metre deep cut along approximately 11 metres of the face of the cliff, because that does two things. That will save the council if it does fall. Then the council will have to come along and repair it. At what cost, I don't know. If they stabilise this to the satisfaction of the ground people, and also I'm not sure whether the government department now is involved much with that landslip, who's managing that landslip area in Taroona. I know it's been monitored now for some 15, 20 years possibly. But that's my view. I believe that architecturally, I think it could be achieved and will save money to our council, because as I said, if you look at the pictures and that cliff front drops, then it will be up to the council to reimburse, in my opinion. Maybe not, but that's my opinion.
There are no other lights on, so I'll speak now. My first question is in relation to, on page 65, it talks about council. It's noted that the previous professional indemnity claim brought against the council by the owners of 20 Kringle Court in 1997, and there was an outcome of this, was council was ordered to pay damages $202,000. But it goes on to say the erosion risk and particulars of the two situations are not equivalent. I've got two questions. The first question is, if it's not seen to be equivalent, why is it included in the report? The second question is, it appears... Actually, we'll go with that first. My first question is, why is that included if the two outcomes are not equivalent?
Through you, Mayor. It's included as... it's not exactly the same scenario, but it's an example of where council's made a decision as the ultimate decision maker and has been liable for works that have occurred in that area, being the subdivision itself and the failure that occurred on that property. Obviously, the failure on this property is more significant and risk to person as opposed to the drainage issues that are at the one that's mentioned. And it's relevant in terms of the council can't just say there were other experts and we put our hands up, that we're not the ones that were the experts in the field, we are the decision maker. And this was run past council's lawyer as well, planning lawyer, about that and whether there was a possibility to put a condition on if we approved it that essentially said if it fails you can't come after council, but there is a Supreme Court decision based in Western Australia that doesn't stand up. You can't just put a condition on that levers that responsibility off us.
So following on from that, what advice does council have, presumably from Mr. Armstrong, that it could potentially be liable for the failure of the development should the planning authority approve this DA?
Sorry, Mayor, can you please say the question again?
The report, that particular section insinuates that council may have some legal risk, some risk of litigation based on a 1997 non-equivalent precedent in the reference to the Western Australian Supreme Court decision. Does council have any specific advice from Mr. Armstrong that if this DA was approved and the structure failed, that council would have legal liability having approved the development?
In response, Mayor, there's no specific advice on that because it's always tested in the courts. It's up to the courts, so we can't predict exactly how the court would go. But caution was put forward about it because of these other decisions that relate to it that say you can't just step away from the responsibility. Of course, there is a possibility that it doesn't fail, that it all goes fine and never fails. But there is that risk, and it would be tested in the courts. And obviously, regardless of the outcome of that, the court proceedings are extremely expensive.
In terms of the another question, in terms of the planning scheme and the provisions within it, does the plan, is this question of legal risk relevant to the planning scheme? I read reason for refusal number 4, and I was concerned that it appeared that council was reluctant to approve this development because of perceived legal risk, and that may be seen as a reason why we should refuse. My question is it a legitimate reason to refuse an application because of this legal risk, or is that just a point which is irrelevant to the scheme?
In response, Mayor, the condition, as I read it, and I'm happy to just have a minute to just reread it, but it's not suggesting that the decision's made about liability. It's making reference to the experts providing advice to this, are disclaiming their liability. And the clause, if you go back to 3.7.3, which if I scroll back...
Sorry, what number was that?
3.73, yeah. But that's not the section, that's the section of the scheme. On page 74, the base, it does talk about the acceptable risks. The scheme is a bit loose on what acceptable risks are, and they leave that up to the responsible authority to determine. And obviously, if it was tested in a court or at a tribunal, that would be fleshed out further. But that's what the base of the risk is, that we don't find that risk is acceptable.
But doesn't the geotechnical report say that the risk is acceptable?
It does, based on a number of assumptions.
Yeah. And again, in point four of the refusal, the proposed refusal, it says that, however, in the event that these assumptions are incorrect, so in the event that the expert that was brought in, I'm sure at great cost and with has great expertise, if they're wrong and cliff line recession rate is faster and the level of risk to life and property may increase to a level where it is no longer acceptable. I mean, it's a slippery slope argument, but if you start questioning every piece of expert advice, when we get our flood mapping in, it says that an area won't flood, do we start saying, well, we won't approve things, even though the flood mapping says that area won't flood? Do we say, well, actually, if the expert is wrong, that might flood, so we're not going to approve that either? I just think this idea here in reason four that we shouldn't, that we should refuse the application because the expert might be wrong, is a really troubling approach and something that I haven't seen before. The other reasons for refusal, I think, are tenuous at best. That it conflicts with the local area objective, Taruna, identifying that existing large lot sizes are to be retained. Well, that's not being proposed to change here. The lot sizes are changing. Given that the proposal includes a 3-metre excavation of the cliff face, it will consequently alter the natural landscape. Again, I don't think this will stack up in the Planning Appeals Tribunal if it's taken there. Two, the proposal does not adequately satisfy performance criteria 3, the clause 12.4.2, with the setbacks and building envelope, because the excavation to the cliff and will create a lower story of dwelling, which will be a detriment to the natural landscape of the cliff and to the amenity of the public using the beach below. Again, I think that is a long bow to take. The beach is some well over 10 metres below the cliff face. We're talking about, I think it's 1 or 1.5 metre overhang. I don't think that's an unreasonable, in my opinion, that's not unreasonable. And again, I don't think that will stack up, and it certainly doesn't for me. It also says that it doesn't adequately satisfy performance criteria P1 with the site coverage because of the excavation of the cliff, which will result in unreasonable detrimental impact to the natural landscape. But it also says within the report that this isn't going to remove, the excavation won't remove vegetation or high conservation vegetation. It's just a cliff face. There is already an existing home here. The proposal is to demolish an existing... It's already a developed block, underdeveloped block. Someone is proposing to come into Taruna, demolish an existing dwelling and build something which will be quite spectacular if you look at the designs. The proponent wants to build something that's architecturally unique and spend a lot of money on the development. I don't think there are enough grounds here to refuse. And my concern when it comes to risk of litigation is that this goes to the Planning Appeals Tribunal, because I don't think the reasons are strong enough. Legal risk that someone might come after us in 50 years' time because the building's failed isn't going to stack up. It's not in the planning scheme. And the reasons in terms of 1, 2 and 3, again, I think are tenuous and will struggle to be upheld. I think councillors should very critically consider whether or not they should be voting against this and looking at an alternative motion to approve the development. I still don't have any... Oh, I do. Councillor Cordover.
Thank you, Mayor. My opinion coincides with the recommendations as outlined in the report. For a number of reasons. Probably the most important one is how the proposal does not adequately satisfy a number of performance criteria, but particularly when we think about that fundamental aspect of risk. And it says right there in the conclusion that the proposed development maximises exposure to these risks through locating the development on the highest hazard parts of the site. Now, there is an alternative, and the alternative is mentioned that for the proposed development, it would be more desirable to set the dwelling back further from the cliff to provide sufficient room to establish stabilising vegetation to assist in minimising future erosion. So we've touched on a number of issues, and I appreciate the Mayor's contribution, and I think that the Mayor has made a number of good points. But fundamentally, given the change to natural landforms, it says the proposal is inconsistent with the objectives of Schedule 1 of the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act 1993. It's considered that the proposal is not in line with Objective B of the local area objectives. It doesn't comply with the front setback. The proposal conflicts with Clause 12.1.2, that's the local area objectives one, does not adequately satisfy performance criteria P3 of Clause 12.4.2, doesn't adequately satisfy performance criteria P1 of 12.4.3, does not adequately satisfy performance criteria P1, A, B or I of Clause E11.7.1, and does not adequately satisfy the Coastal Erosion Hazard Code, including Clauses E16.1.1, E2 and E16.7.1, P1. So for all of those reasons, and acknowledging that there is an alternative that exists here, and the alternative does not go for the very most risky proposal, for that reason I will be voting in favour of the recommendations of the planning officer. Thank you.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you everyone for their contribution. I am looking to support, as written by the officer's recommendation. I actually have a few questions that I'd like to know. As we understand, this is when we see this at a council meeting, it's not the first time that, you know, this development comes to our officers and they look at it and it gets, you know, to this level. I think there's often a lot of negotiations and discussions with the developer. And I guess what I'm wanting to know is what is sort of the history of this proposal? Had they put in, is this the initial proposal they put in? Have they had discussions with our officers? Have they been offered the recommendations? Have they been shown these recommendations in the report that they haven't met the scheme and other areas and other statements that have been made? Were they aware of that it wasn't going to be recommended? Did they actually look at providing some changes and modifications, or was the developer just happy to sort of put this forward? So there's a couple of questions in that. Just wondering a bit more of the history of the proposal and if they had made any modifications in line with officers' recommendations.
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, the applicant was... We have had discussions with the applicant, the officer that was dealing with the application. There were further information requests as well for additional reports and questioning some of the reports as well to get the detail. So they did have the opportunity to do it, to change it if they wanted, but they have chosen to stick with the main concept of cutting out the cliff to insert the building into the cliff.
Thank you. And can you please explain, so I can get some more understanding of the moderate geoconservation values?
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, I would rather not make comment about the details of that. I'm not qualified in that area to make comment further than what's actually written in the reports.
Okay, thank you. I just think with knowing that there is increased erosion and landslide issues and our municipality, we have to be very careful in our decisions regarding this planning application and future planning applications. And I'm really happy with the advice that has been provided. I can hear the points that the Mayor has made, that there is uncertainty, but I just think it's important to listen to the advice that has been given.
Just a question on Councillor Midley. If our planner's not qualified enough to speak on the issue you raised, wasn't we assured by the general manager tonight that we have qualified people in the room, or is that
Councillor Grace?
The, so the question is, who else can answer that question?
That was the question was fine, but the Councillor Mitchell's question was very specific around the geotechnical of the rocks, and I think Ms. Tyler Moore's position is that she's not a geologist and would find it difficult to answer the question. If you're asking whether we can have a geologist in the room when we debate DAs, the answer is no, we can't. No, we don't. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, this is a DA that I've struggled with for many of the same reasons that you've identified. The paragraphs 1 through 5 of the recommended motion I see as being subjective, and on balance I would take the view that, that the performance criteria have been met and there's no particular significance to the landscape that will be affected by the excavation of the cliff face, particularly in any adverse way. Obviously, paragraph 6 is a significant concern and the Coastal Erosion Hazard Code for many of the reasons that have been identified in the report and identified by other councillors as well. Having said this, we have a geotechnical report which does state that the development is achievable in a safe manner and provides recommendations for that to occur. So I struggle with the idea that the criteria in the Hazard Code can't be met at all. The question of risk is one that is always going to come about, and the question of balancing that risk and who takes on that risk. And then the question of legal liability as well. But quite rightly, Mayor, as you've pointed out, legal liability is not a consideration under the planning scheme. And so for that reason, it does concern me that that was included in the report, and it does concern me that the particular case that's mentioned was used in the report as well. When the judgment in that case is actually read, it's quite clearly very different to the circumstances that may arise in the approval of this application, if that were to take place. The case that was mentioned was to do with redirection of stormwater flows and acts and omissions of council in relation to neighbouring properties. That simply doesn't bear any relevance to the development application that we're reviewing, let alone any relevance to the planning scheme. And so I do question why it was included in the first place. I'd also question why we would have approached council's lawyer to obtain advice about the inclusion of a condition seeking to remove liability and yet not also at the same time seeking advice about what our potential liability might be. Of course, those matters are going to be tested in court if litigation ever arises. However, advice is what lawyers do, and it surprises me that that wasn't obtained in this case. So, Mayor, on balance, the subjective criteria, the performance criteria, those subjective considerations in 1 through 5, I do not agree with the report's conclusions. And with respect to 6, I would say that the geotechnical assessment that was provided to Council showed that there was a reduced hazard way of this development application going forward. If it's refused tonight, like you, Mayor, I will be interested to see how the matter goes forward, if at all.
You'd foreshadow an alternative motion if you were, if this is lost, is that correct?
Look, Mayor, it concerns me that we would be doing it on the fly.
Like, no, we have one prepared.
We have one prepared.
Yes.
I would need to see that proposed motion.
Yeah,
but
you can foreshadow and you may, yeah, then gives us options. So. Councillor Bastone.
I will be supporting the recommendation. I've heard nothing that persuades me to do otherwise at the moment. When you look on page 81 about the works including a 3 metre deep cut on 11 metres of cliff face and then extending back 13 metres, this is a huge area. This is I think on my bad maths, 429 cubic metres of land that's going to be altered. Now, I can't see how this is sort of set right in. I can see all sorts of drainage problems there. I know they say they'll fix it, but I do have a worry about that. And on page 82, it says in the top paragraph, the existing deck currently exists out over the cliff face by approximately 1 metre. When the new proposed viewing platform will extend a further 2.87 metres. So we're now hanging over the beach by 3.87 metres. Now, this is not an inconsequential piece, and I would like to know if it would be okay at my house if I build right on the boundary and then extend out over the road for 10 feet, because that's what this is doing. It's over a public area by 3.87 metres. This is a very large overhang, which will definitely alter the sunshine on the beach. It will alter the way the water falls onto the beach. There's no way I could support such an application.
Councillor Westwood.
Thank you. I had a question around if this is approved tonight, based on the recommendations in the report we have. The recommendations refer to a soil and water management plan, no footings that reside in the erosion zone, the building is to be supported entirely within the stable foundation zone, etc., etc. There's quite a few there. How would they be incorporated into any approval of this development application?
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, it would be conditioned on the permit that they have to submit the plans, and it's up to the experts to come up with the solutions of how they're going to achieve that.
So would we put those conditions on tonight, on the fly, or would we be coming back? Would this be coming back to council with those attached?
Ms. Tollemore.
Through you, Mayor, we've already prepared the conditions. If there was as an alternate recommendation, if it was overturned, and they're included in those conditions, which should it be moved, will be displayed for the councillors to consider.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, no, Councillor Wass.
Thank you, Mayor. I think the councillors around the room that have supported the motion have possibly covered all the points that I could cover. I think there are six reasons, both printed on pages 82 to 83. We have our own expert in Chris Sharples, who has identified this cliff as an assessment under the coastal hazard and as having potentially increased risk of erosion. So I think we need to take that into consideration. The cut is not going to be a small cut, and as indicated, it's going to stretch over 4 metres out. I think the main issue, and certainly what staff are concerned about, that the experts for the developer providing that advice disclaim any liability whatsoever arising from any of their assumptions, whether those assumptions are correct or incorrect, and acknowledge that we as the planning authority, the buck ends with us. So it could be $1 million if we agree to this and it all falls apart and goes egg-shaped. And I don't believe that our ratepayers should be looking at $1 million or any other amount to, when quite clearly the staff recommendation has been to refuse. And on that basis, Mayor, I'm happy to support the recommendation to refuse.
Councillor Fox, sum up.
I'm hesitant to say that I've had a history of this with this site, because I haven't mentioned it in my arguments originally, but listening to the debate to support or to not support the motion for refusal raises deep concerns with me. I used to attend Taruna High School, and at that time there were large slippages below this site which have not been recorded. Also, I know that council has got major infrastructure at the top of this site, which was put in also by council under Max Doyle. And they have had major concerns of that being eroded by the slippage of this cliff. That hasn't been mentioned in the report.
We've also had legal advice a number of years ago which quoted the Byron Bay example that quite clearly demonstrated that any works that are approved by council on a coastal environment, on a mobile coastal environment, that council is liable for. And the gentleman from New South Wales came and spoke to us at length. I think the only person on staff who was at that meeting is now Tony Ferrier, who may be able to back me up. I'm very concerned about the liability aspect, particularly as there are no details in how any supporting information from the developer, how they are going to mitigate the erosion. And I hope that this motion of refusal is passed, because I would hazard a guess that if we do overturn this decision, it will be very expensive for council and a very bad precedent. Thank you.
Okay, the motion moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Midgley, is that the Planning Authority resolves that the development application, demolition and construction of dwelling at 30 Keringle Court, Taroona, for ERA planning be refused for the following reasons. I think there are six reasons. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Have a division. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillors Bastone, Westwood, Fox, Cordova, Midgley, Wass, and those against is Councillors Grace, Street and Winter, and the motion is carried. We move on. The Planning Authority session adjourns and the open session commences at 6:40 p.m. So we move to notices of motion. The first motion that has been given on notice is from Councillor Midgley, headed Vehicle Fleet, with an officer's response there. Do you formally move that, Councillor Midgley? Would someone like to second it?
Sorry, I'm just wondering if we should move the Bruny Island boat shed. Or can we do that?
The Bruny Island boat shed, do we want to move that?
Not now.
Not now. We could have earlier.
All right, we just always ends up like that.
Councillor Fox is seconded. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you also, Mayor, for your inspiration in putting this motion forward after a few discussions. I feel like it's an important motion because as a council we have an obligation to manage our assets in the best interests of our community, and by shifting council fleets to electric vehicle could save money and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I'd love to see it if, as a council, we had a target for our fleet to move to electric vehicles. Say we had a goal of by 2030, 80% of our fleet were electric vehicles, and I think this motion and request for a report is about starting that conversation. Doing a bit of research, wondering what other local government areas are moving in this way. I noted that the City of Sydney has embraced electric vehicles with 40 hybrid cars and 70 hybrid trucks. And by using electric and hybrid trucks and vehicles, the city has reduced its fleet emissions by 26% between 2010 and 2014. And we know that we're running out of time. To take serious action on climate change and transition to electric vehicles is one way to reduce our emissions. So I thank Mr. Doole. I don't think he's here tonight. I think it's something also that he has also considered, as we can see by the report that has been attached, to provide a great analysis for council to consider re-electric fleet and charging stations. I hope that we can be provided with some further financial information for budget considerations, e.g. if we do have a goal for a large percentage of our fleet to transition to electric vehicles by 2030, it would be interesting to understand what would need to be considered in the budget for the next 9 years to achieve this. So I hope other councillors support this motion.
There are no other lights on. Oh, Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. I wholeheartedly support this request for a report, but also I would like to extend our expectations rather than downsize them. I had a quick question because we've heard from Councillor Midgley about the fact that we're in a climate emergency means that we actually need to act like there is an emergency and there is an expectation on us from the community that we do so. Some of the recommendations, or not recommendations, but it's pointed out in the report this particular report mentions the idea of buying one electric vehicle, and I think the community expectation is such that in a climate emergency, we should actually be considering transitioning the entire vehicle fleet over to electric vehicles and hybrids as soon as possible. So I really hope that the tyranny of low expectations does not seep into our report when it comes to what kind of a budget proposal we're going to make in order to achieve a rapid transition to electric vehicles. I have a question. What is the total number of vehicles in the council fleet at the moment?
Mr. Breen, are you the closest and most likely to know the answer? Oh, Mr. Smead, you know? Oh, Mr. Johnson.
I think there's one hybrid vehicle on staff currently. Yep, that's correct. But there certainly is an assumption that we'd be moving all of our light fleet to hybrid vehicles at the bare minimum.
And how many are in that light fleet through you, Mayor?
A light fleet.
Through you, Mayor. I can't answer that. I'd have to take that on notice, sorry.
Less than 100? More than 100? A million? Okay. So my question... I've got another question, if you'll indulge me, Mayor, and that is...
Mr. Breen. Yeah, through the Chair, there would be about 20 vehicles in the light fleet.
Great, thank you. Thanks very much. I think it's really important, talking about expectations, that there's a recognition that the community at the annual general meeting, they proposed that, and it was passed with flying colours. In fact, there was only one person who voted against the idea of providing more resources to tackle climate change, and this is one of those elements of tackling the climate emergency. I note with some regret that on page 125 there's a mention there that being currently under development, it may be possible to integrate the development of a fast charge site at the planning stage with reference to the old Kingston High School site, that is Kingston Park, reducing cost and improving the final layout compared to trying to fit it into an existing site. The reason I raise that is just because we have this tremendous opportunity at Kingston Park for fast charge EV options, and I'm really concerned that that opportunity is being underutilised. I really do think that when it comes to rolling out electric vehicle supply equipment, the onus is on us to progress that as rapidly as we can and recognise that a climate emergency requires us to do a lot more than we're currently doing. And if you look at a place like Norway, where 40% of the vehicles are now electric, or if you look at what's happening in China, you know, we're in the richest country in the world in the richest time in human history, and right now I fear that our priorities are not adequately addressing the climate emergency that we're in. And so I really hope that the report that comes back to us has details about what exactly would be best practice and would be a best case scenario, and I really hope that when that report does come back and budget deliberations are made, that the council recognises that we have declared a climate emergency and we really need to start acting like it is an emergency. Thank you.
Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor, and thanks to Councillor Midgley for bringing this forward, because there are environmental benefits from a transition to electric vehicles. There are, however, a number of barriers which are likely to reduce over the medium term but still present challenges at the moment. So we've got charging infrastructure, we've got limited models of electric vehicles that are available in the Australian market. We've got, as I said, lack of public charging infrastructure to support longer drives around the state. We've got the higher purchase price of electric vehicles compared to the traditional internal combustion engine equivalents. And there's also a limited market to dispose of the vehicles at the end of their life. I know that this notice of motion is only requesting a report, but I feel that we already have a report here in our agenda paper. I have a couple of questions. The report mentions charging. So these vehicles obviously need to be charged. Often that takes quite some time. So are we expecting our employees, if we go to fully electric vehicles as opposed to a hybrid vehicle, are we expecting council staff to bear the cost of charging these vehicles at home?
Councillor West, just remember we are only debating whether to get a report on it. Okay. So these are great questions to ask
if we get a report. I'm happy to take your question, though. It's perfectly, you're perfectly entitled to ask a question.
Well,
you want to?
Yeah. So are we expecting Mr. Johnson, employees to charge vehicles at home?
You? No. Mr. Breen? Sorry.
Through the chair, council has a plant committee which looks after the motor vehicle side of the council's business, and as part of that it's starting to turn its thought to electric vehicles, and part of the discussion has been that if we had employees that needed to charge their vehicles overnight at home, then council would have to reimburse the employee for the cost of undertaking that activity.
And the report that we already have mentions the cost of installing the charging, what are they called, the infrastructure. Are we going to be installing chargers at council?
Doesn't really relate to the motion, Councillor Westwood.
Okay. Well, I guess my point is we already have a fairly comprehensive report which raises issues around the budget, and although I think that in future there's reasons to move towards fully electric vehicles, I think the report we have, for me, already says that I think we're a bit early in doing that.
Councillor Loss.
Thank you, Mayor. The response provided does support or does provide a lot of information to us, but it doesn't cover all of what the recommendation is, and therefore I support the recommendation. At this point in time, electric vehicles are the way of the future. There was last year, the state government provided funding for charging stations. To my knowledge, I don't know whether or not we put an application in. Certainly to the north, they have them, and certainly to the south. I think Huon Valley have 3 stations, so we're left lagging behind. I think we need to seriously look at the reasons and actions to support, not the reasons to deny going forward. And as community is willing, and community is certainly willing to look at electric vehicles, we should show leadership, provide this report, and to work out how we can make it happen. Because if we say no to this report or this notice of motion tonight, it might be 12 months that we bring it up again. And then we never make a decision. I think it's time to make the decision. I think our community wants us to make the decision. And in the interests of our children's children and their children, we need to make this decision. So, Mayor, I will certainly fully support this recommendation.
Councillor Fox.
Yes, I would also support it. I do recall that Councillor Woss, when he was mayor, had a hybrid car which I drove to Devonport or Launceston at one stage, and it didn't require any charging along the way. It was a Leaf, was it not? No? We had the Leaf. It was a council car, was it? Sorry. Anyway, we did have one, and it was very well used by councillors. And also, we're one of the first councils that have provided electric bikes, and I think that's a really good initiative too, because that's getting cars off the road. I've personally travelled from Palmerston North to Wellington and charged a Leaf along the way, and it didn't take very long. It gave us some time to have a cup of coffee and do some shopping and then move on and have a break along the way. And I've always thought that local government is the ideal location for charge points. It would be an ideal way of us to promote the other services that we provide and also support other councils to have similar charge points. And I think it's a very important thing that we look at this from a staff point of view, that they are able to use electric cars. It's a bit like having solar panels on the roof now, which we have many of. It's just another way of moving with the technology that is available and is becoming more affordable. And if we, as Councillor Woss said, if we are leaders in this field, then it will become more affordable and more practical for the community to come on board. So I thoroughly recommend the motion. Thank you.
A question. Yeah, just a question, Mayor. Does this recommendation as written in your opinion or somebody else's opinion, does it have enough clarity about... My question is it likely that the report, if it comes before council, will make specific recommendations about preferred options and estimated costs for, firstly, the number of electric vehicles to be purchased by the council, and secondly, the number of charge points, including purchase, installation and placement of electric vehicle supply equipment in Kingborough for the budget deliberations? And if not, do you think an amendment needs to be passed to specify that? Because that's really the crux of this thing.
General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Even though Mr. Doole is not currently... Pardon me, sorry about the voice. Even though Mr. Doole, my colleague, is not currently in attendance at this meeting and is the most likely author of a report should the notice of motion go ahead, the feedback from the discussion and the audio will be available to Mr. Doole, and I'm sure that all of the points raised tonight will be considered in some shape or form in any report.
There are no other lights on. Councillor Midgley, would you like to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. Just to note that doing a little bit of research around Australia and many councils are heading in this direction, and I also note that the Climate Works Australia consulted with 43 local governments across Victoria that considered approach findings, recommendations for scaling into the future, and I hear Councillor Westwood, for some councils there was some budget, heavy budget considerations as to why or why not they do, but I think there's a lot of information out there for Mr. Doole to consider, as well as hearing from councillors tonight to look forward to whether we're ready to embrace this change for the future.
So the motion on vehicle fleet was moved by Councillor Midgley, seconded by Councillor Fox, and the motion reads that a report will be provided to Council which outlines the costs and benefits, financial and greenhouse, of moving a larger share of Kingborough's vehicle fleet to full electric-powered vehicles, as well as electric vehicle charge station options before the finalisation of the draft budget. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? I have a division. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Councillor Grace, Street, Bastone, Fox, Cordova, Midgley, Wass and Winter. And those against is Councillor Westwood. Next item is... Sister City Relationship, and there's a notice of motion put forward by Councillor Fox. Councillor Fox, do you move the motion as printed? It's on page 128. Seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Fox.
Sorry. At the motion last year where we decided not to continue with the Abel Tasman Art Prize, there was quite a lot of discussion around alternative forms of continuing the sister city relationship with the Best Quartier Council of Holland and Kingborough, which has a very long history. And there are a lot of people in this community who have benefited by the relationship as well as those in Holland. I note that the former Mayor, Councillor Wass, has recently been to Westerkwartier and has caught up with the Mayor of the day and also the other councillors, and has expressed enthusiasm for the continuation of this relationship, and the current mayor of Westerkwartier, Art van der Turk, also rang Councillor Winter, who I'm sure will expand on that conversation. Would you like me to?
Yes.
Well, some of it was in Dutch, but most of it... just to summarise, I guess Westerkwartier is a combination of three large councils in Northern Holland, and they have recently had a meeting and decided they are very keen, as a new council, an amalgamated council, to continue with the cordial relations that they have with Kingborough. In fact, they have been speaking with the ambassador to the Netherlands from Australia, and also the Australian... The Netherlands ambassador to Australia. And both of these ambassadors are very keen to see our sister city relationship flourish, because we're one of the few examples at local government level that is supporting this concept in Holland. Basically, there are very few linkages between the higher levels of government in both Holland and Australia to the level that we have got this relationship. They have had ideas around Anzac Day and how many of the Anzac soldiers from Australia actually came to Holland during the liberation of Holland from the Germans, and a lot of people in Australia are highly regarded by the Dutch community. And likewise, I guess many of the resistance workers who lived in Holland are now members of our community in Tasmania, and particularly in Kingborough. Most of the Calvin Christian school and the both the original settlers in Tasmania who came and built that school and also the church were a group of friends who'd worked in the resistance together and then came to live in Tasmania to make a new start. And I think that is really quite a critical route that council could follow in terms of the military support and the military relationships we might have across both countries. The other issues we have in common are floods. Holland's well known for having had floods. They've got a wall around the entire country to stop floods occurring, and they're well aware of climate change issues and sea level rise. In fact, they recently went to Tasman Council in New Zealand to give a talk about this very issue, because our Grote Gast Council had experts in this area.
Point. What are we discussing all this for when we're only recognising, are we going to get a report into it? I mean, it's nice to know the history, but surely we can do that at a workshop. This is a simple...
Thanks, Councillor. So your point of order is on relevance. Look, I'm listening. To me, it's still relevant to the motion. The motion is very broad, that we should look at cultural projects to facilitate. And my listening to Councillor Fox, she's outlining some of the cultural relationship we have, and I don't think there's much time left anyway, so we should
Well, I guess they're very concerned. Art van der Turk, Mayor Art van der Turk, who's been appointed by the King as both Mayor and General Manager to that council, was full of questions about the fires and how they've affected Australia and how concerned the European community is about the loss of animals and the loss of vegetation, but particularly the loss of lives to fires. So they kind of empathise with us. He couldn't find the right word, but they live through us. When they have the relationship with us, they like to hear what we have to say, how we feel, how we think. And likewise, we think people in Australia would like to hear how people in Holland have, what their concerns are, what their views are, and what cultural exchange programs we might be able to devise amongst us. And they just want us to get to sit down and give it some thought and provide some ideas and feedback to their desires. Thank you.
Councillor Bastone.
I'm just wondering, if this report is provided to council, if the report could also just look at the point, what is the point of a sister city relationship, and would it not be better to get rid of it altogether?
General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Councillor Vastar, I understand your sentiment, but it would be contrary to this notice of motion.
Councillor Watts.
Thank you, Mayor. I support this motion. The people of Grootegast, as it was, and now Wester Kwartier, certainly value the sister city relationship that they've had with Kingborough. If you visit their municipality, both expanded and original, you will note that there is a lot of plaques, both theirs and ours, on display, a lot of comments in relation to the state and federal government that, if you'd like, mention us. It was an amicable arrangement that we had with the Abel Tasman Art Prize, which saw, I guess, a need for change, and certainly both councils agreed to that. The things that we can gain from them is obviously the issues that we have in our municipality that they have in theirs. The social disadvantage and the social
attitudes within their municipality, and including employment, where people go away for employment, the geographic locations and what surrounds them, and of course climate change. We're looking at a sister city relationship that we can work on, that staff and councillors can take advantage of, and really there is no upfront and ongoing dollar cost. So I believe that we certainly need to continue our sister city relationship, and I think we can learn from them as well as they can learn from us, and on that basis I'm happy to support the motion.
Yes, I have to say I'm more enthusiastic about this after having spoken to the mayor of the municipality. I need to learn to pronounce before I say it publicly, but I will. It was a good conversation. I'm glad Councillor Fox was there, because there was a lot of Dutch spoken, and Councillor Fox has a very good understanding of the background of the relationship. The reason I'm more enthusiastic is because of what Councillor Fox touched on, which is about the reference to the Dutch and Australian embassies. If the mayor is correct and there is interest and enthusiasm for this through within those embassies, then to me any sister city relationship that we hold should include input and potentially funding from those embassies, because if we are doing something that's good for the relationship between the Netherlands and Australia, then I would have thought we'd be funded to do that. So that'd be a good thing to do. Oh, the only concern I've got with it is probably that the author of the motion probably knows more about this than anyone that's going to write a report. So I hope that Councillor Fox is consulted when the report's written, or that if there is going to be a brainstorming session, someone with, or even Councillor Woss, who's got some background, would be included in that, because I'm sure they'll have some ideas. But we haven't. The preface of the meeting that we had with the mayor was actually about the Abel Tasman Art Prize and whether our decision was final, that it was finished, and we reiterated that our decision is final and that we're not going to participate in any further. But there was some excitement about looking at some new ways to further the relationship. So I think it's well worth a report and a consideration of, given the history of it and the fact that it exists and that we have a large Dutch population here, it makes sense to have a look at it and see what opportunities there are. Any further? There's no other lights on, so I'm going to ask Councillor Fox to summarise if you'd like.
Thank you, Mayor. I think you've summarised it very well, and I'm looking forward to the report.
The motion was moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Midgley, and it's that a report be provided on options for cultural projects to facilitate relationships between the sister cities of Westerwaarder Council and Kingborough Council, particularly between young people from both councils, following the demise of the Abel Tasman Art Prize. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, over division. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillor Grace, Councillor Street, Councillor Bastone, Councillor Fox, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Woss, Councillor Winter, and those against, Councillor Westwood. Next item is petitions still... Sorry, that motion is carried. The next item is petitions still being actioned. At the time the report was written, there were no petitions still being actioned. Petitions received last period. At the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions have been received. Officers reports to council. We go to the annual budget mid-year review, and the recommended motion is on page 134. Looking for a mover and a seconder of that motion. Councillor Westwood, seconded by Councillor Fox. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank Mr. Breen for the mid-year review. I think it's a really great addition to the annual budget process, and I hope that potentially we can include mid-year reviews in future budget years. I think it's a really great report, identifies some of the challenges we're facing at the moment. Not as positive as I was hoping it would be, but nonetheless outlines the budget situation and gives us a heads up that we have some difficult decisions coming up. in the next few months as we try and prioritise our expenditure for the next financial year. This also recommends a reallocation of some funding within the existing capital program to some other projects. That seems like a sensible thing to do at this point in time until we have some more certainty around what we're doing in the Kingston CBD. So I thank Mr. Breen for the report.
I'm not sure who was next. It was either Councillor Street or Bastone.
I'll go
Councillor
first.
Bastone.
I'll go first. Mine's very short. In the depreciation, which is now $500,000 above what it was going to be, I'm just wondering, it says here, as a result of this work, a number of components of building assets have been assigned reduced useful lives, which resulted in an additional $300,000 in depreciation. Which were these building assets that have been looked at?
Mr. Breen.
Through the chair, essentially all our building assets were componentised. So effectively what that means is, if we take a look at this building here, the building would have been depreciated previously over a 50-year life. Effectively what's happened now is the main structure is still 50 years, but for instance the roof has been given a new life, probably 20 years, 20 to 30 years. The cladding have a different life. The electricals, the lift, they would all have different lives. So rather than having it all in one big bucket, now there's about 10 different buckets with different assets sitting in it. And the useful life more realistically reflects the amount of time that that asset is believed to be able to last. So what it's done is effectively brought the increased the depreciation because it's depreciated now over 20 years, for example, rather than over 50 years. And that's happened on all buildings.
Castle Street.
Just a couple of questions, Mayor. On the depreciation at 4.2, my Roman numerals are worse than Dennis Minuto's 18, Roman numeral 18. Depreciation. So my understanding was that the componentisation work had been finished in the last financial year. And I distinctly remember having a conversation about the fact that that the big variance was not going to occur again this year because the work had been completed. Do I recall that correctly, or has there been some carryover into this financial year?
Mr. Breen.
Through the chair, essentially the original target was last financial year to get the componentisation underway and completed. However, unfortunately, it was delayed in getting the information together. We had to get a consultant in to do the work and write the report. So essentially it's been delayed 12 months and this is the outcome for this year.
My only other question is just in relation to 4.2 Roman numeral... one. the rates. That was a toughie. The rates increase. I assume that the majority of this is attributable to new subdivisions where there's been revaluations of lots following title issue. Is that correct?
Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through the chair. Essentially, there's probably a mixture of two things. The first you outlined, certainly the activity's been a lot greater than was originally put in the budget, and therefore we're about $70,000 to $80,000 over in regards to our sup income at this stage. The rest of it really relates to, remember this budget was put together in about March last year, so we had two quite large subs last year that we didn't expect to have that came in, so it gave us an additional starting point. So I think we started about 120, 130 over at the start of the year.
Councillor Grace.
Now, I just sort of, I'm on page 132 and I won't keep them waiting because we've been waiting for this boat shed, and so I said I want to bring it forward, but I didn't get the support. No, well, why didn't we bring it forward?
anyway, let's carry on. Now, I'm concerned about all this over expenditure on these projects, particularly capital works. How much of this is accomplished by our documentation? Is our documentation up to standard? In some cases, I heard it's not, and that's why it's costing us extra money. I don't know for sure. I've asked this question before, particularly on the Esplanade at Margate, where I was never ever provided that information. But I am concerned. You got 250,000 overspent, 75,000, 120, 60,000, 50,000, and then 200. You know, I mean, it's got to be related to something. I know you do estimates, and that's over and above the contingency sum, as I read it. Some projects have 300,000 or 400,000 or 50,000 or whatever in there as a contingency sum. I'm just concerned. I think we need to be more, and this is where we lack now, meeting twice a month, where before, when we had the committees and we had the, excuse me, do you mind, I get a little bit cheesed off when you're not interested when I speak. I pay you people the courtesy, and particularly when it's late at night, and I'm not, I just get frustrated. But Mayor, I'm only wasting my time talking, so I won't say no more, because councillors don't care how much it costs this council, and let's put it on the record, that is the fact. Councils are not interested.
Councillor Watts.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a couple of observations. I'm concerned that the depreciation remains fluid. That I thought we had under control, but again, it's moving around, and I know there's circumstances, but I'd like to see that under control. The other part, which has been touched on, is our capital works budgets generally seem to continue to be underestimated, and I think we need to take a sharper pencil to this and work out real costs rather than hopeful or wishful costs. And I guess I look there at John Street, which was going to be a small upgrade in my thoughts, which is already $290,000 behind the eight ball. The worst part of this recommendation is that the Channel Highway is again put on the back burner. I mean, this is on the back burner for, I'd probably, three decades this has gone on. And the community have been calling for it and calling for it, but again, there's something comes up every time that we get close to doing it, and all of a sudden we transfer money away from the Channel Highway and we do something else. And I think it's time the Channel Highway got done once and for all, for better or for worse, but it needs to be done, and it needs to be done sooner rather than later, because we keep talking about it. We've got an opportunity to make the gateway into our area nice, modern, convenient, but yet we've got perhaps the eyesore of any area, well, certainly in the south of Tasmania. So I'd ask that that can be, I won't say resurrected, but if we can have that done as soon as possible. On that basis, I guess I'm going to support the recommendation, but I'm hesitant to do so.
Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a couple of quick ones. I'm just not clear on 4.75, future design projects. What does that mean, future design projects? Page 132.
Mr. Johnson.
Through you, Mayor. I will need to take that on notice. I'll probably need to get some further advice from Mr. Reeve about exactly what that refers to.
Thank you. Just said this budget was accidentally omitted from the original budget. Just want to know what that is. And also, just following on from what...
Mr. Breen.
Breen.
Both Johns, yeah.
Through the chair. Essentially, what we try and do is with our future design, is to, throughout the year, start design work on projects that will be undertaken in the next financial year. So we do a bit of work early on. And I know in the previous budgets we've had that line item in the budget, and clearly it should have been in for this year. So it's really just getting a head start, because if you only start your project in July once the budget's approved, then you find that you're 2 or 3 months into the year before you can actually start going out to tender, and quite often then it doesn't get completed in that 12-month period.
Great, thank you. And just noting as well the Brightwater Road Stage 1, how much over expense there was in regards to that, and hopefully with Brightwater Stage 2 that we have considered some of those over expense items. When I was at one of the KBAC meetings, I heard there was discussion around bicycle lines and things like that, perhaps looking along that side of the road. When we're looking at our road developments and upgrades, do we consult with KBAC, I guess, initially to look if there are any ideas for bicycle lines and things that can be embedded into the budget? Or
I think that's really relevant.
It's not really, anyway, I guess yeah. It's just that. I guess it's around the question of rather than the expense coming later, we look at the embedding the expense in now as the estimate. I guess that's what it is. So we're not going over and above what the expected expense is. And just the other question around what Councillor Wass raised regarding the Channel Highway, and I've heard many stories of this, of the upgrade over the years. Yes, the community would like to see it happening. We've got the place score at the moment doing the consultation, and I'm just wondering, is there money in the city deal to sort of move this ahead rather than using council funds?
So we... The city deal funding is paying for the place score consultancy and the work that, so it's already paying for it. It's also $800,000 of it will go to new bus infrastructure, which is highly likely to be associated with the design. So there's $800,000 there for the infrastructure. The remaining $20 million is for congestion busting initiatives. We haven't come to an agreement with the state, well, not that we'll come to an agreement, with a draft position on what those projects will be. Once there's a draft position between the state government and council on what those projects will be, that'll come to a council meeting for endorsement by the elected members. I think Councillor Fox was next.
Thank you. I very much agree with Councillor Wass on the Channel Highway project, but I do agree that it's important that the final outcome does reflect what community would like, and the consultant who came to speak to us the other day was extremely good, I thought, and if we can get something out of that to improve the quality for everybody down in the whole area, and that is reflected in Channel Highway, then it's worth the wait. Well, just a general comment that all these amounts of 290,000, 150, 120, 60, etc., they look like huge amounts, but it doesn't reflect the actual cost of those projects, and it's not reflected as a percentage of those projects. So I would wonder whether, I know it's traceable in the very fine print of the attached document, what the actual cost of these projects was or were, but I was wondering whether in future when we have these overruns that we also show what percentage they actually are of how much money, because like if we're spending millions of dollars and we've got a $60,000 overrun, well, we just have to wear it, and it's just a small percentage of the actual cost of the overall project. Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. A question about on page 136 with the capital expenditure, 136, 7 and 8. Can somebody please elaborate on the IMG adjustments? That's in the 7th or 8th column across IMG adjustments.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Breen.
Yeah, through the Chair, Council runs a infrastructure management group and their role is to review the capital program on a monthly basis. As part of that group, there are some delegations in regards to changes to the budgets. So smaller changes tend to go through the infrastructure management group. Larger changes then will go to the General Manager, and if it's beyond that, then it'll come back here to Council.
Councillor Grace.
I have two questions. One, future works. As I understand, the many councillors sitting around this table will remember we put a lot of money into engineering for that purpose, and we've put extra money in each year for that purpose. And one good example is the cycleway. If that wasn't sitting on the drawing board, we would never have got the money. That's the question there. So that is how important it is to have jobs
it's
sitting.
Not a question. It was a great
well,
point.
Well, the question
is,
I'm surprised that we are saying now that we haven't had the funds or the funds wasn't put in the budget.
Thanks, Councillor Grace.
Second question.
Can this one be a question, though?
Listen, Mayor.
I'm not trying to be rude, but it's just that under the regulations, you've already made a contribution. So I'm not trying to be rude, but you have to ask a question as opposed to make a second contribution.
Listen, mate, you sat here and listened for a heap of stuff, and every time I want to say something, you discriminate against me, and I think it's because of my education, Mayor.
No.
And this council is discriminating against me when I open my mouth, and the reason for it is you don't like what I have to say. I am a straight shooter, and as I said before, I am disappointed by the big overspent on these capital works, but my question...
I'm being as polite as I can, I'm just trying to keep you to the meeting procedures regulations that my job is to
well,
uphold.
Well, you read them again and tell me
well, no,
about them.
I have
I
read them.
You don't know them.
Councillor Grace, your light's off, so the recording can't pick you up. What I'm asking you to do is, if you've got a question, you are welcome to ask a question. You've already made your contribution. Everybody, under the meeting procedures regulations, is able to make one contribution per item. You've made yours. So I'm not after... We're not debating it, Councillor Grace. Councillor Grace.
And let's be flexible.
You're not being recorded, Councillor Grace.
Well, you won't record,
no. Councillor Grace, do you have a question?
Absolutely.
So you don't have... If you have a question, you're able to... Great. Very interested in your question.
Now, is it true that no capital works were undertaken for the first 6 months of this financial year?
Mr Johnson.
Now, do you understand that, or do you want me to spell
it out? That's a great question, Councillor Grace. Mr Johnson.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Mr Breen.
Through the chair, for the first 6 months of the year, about $6 million in capital expenditure has been undertaken.
Are there any other contributions? So I had a question. Following on the componentisation issues raised by a couple of councillors, last year we had the componentisation of road assets, and this year we've had the building assets, and both have led to large one-off depreciations that have negatively impacted our budget. And I think the question went along the lines, about this time last year, is this the end of it? When will it end? Will it end, and will we continue to see this? Because last year, I think Mr Reeve, I can't remember the quote, but I think we laughed because he said, I guarantee this won't happen again, or words to that effect. And it has happened again. So when will it stop, Mr Breen?
Yeah, through the chair, this is the last group of assets that we've had to componentise. So it's been an ongoing project for about the last 3 to 4 years, but now it's all completed. So it's really now a matter of us being able to estimate accurately the new assets that we're bringing on board. And so I'm confident from this position on we can get a far greater forecast budget figure that'll be close to the reality.
And so that componentisation or that depreciation that's been added, do you have an estimation on the impact of that on our future budgets?
Through the chair, so essentially this is an ongoing increase. So we've basically just raised the bar essentially in regards to our depreciation. We are spending a fair bit of time at the moment looking at opportunities to reduce depreciation. So we're having a look at what some of the other councils are doing, where there's an opportunity for us to bring that number down. This year, for the first time, we've used the council cost index as an escalator of our asset values before we would go to a consultant and get a figure. So that's brought the escalation down by about 1% per year. So we're looking at all opportunities to reduce our depreciation. It has to be a reflection of the usage of your assets, but there are ways of attempting to minimise it, and we're looking at all those at the moment.
And this,
look, a few of my colleagues made comment around the fact that a lot of these projects, as listed on the screen, particularly John Street, Tolone, Brightwater, have all gone over what the expectation is. We're all exposed to the same information, but I think it's important to note that the building construction industry in Tasmania is going about as well as it's ever gone at the moment, and the simple fact is that building infrastructure at the moment is very expensive, and I suspect that that's the greatest cause of us going over budget. It's been well documented publicly that the cost of the public toilet at Kingston Beach was massively over what we expected, and that was as a result of the tenders coming back in much higher than we expected, and that's a big issue. I don't think we should... there may be issues with the way that we are quoting the jobs, that's true, but I think a big component of that has been just the amount of work that's on, which is obviously great news for the economy, but it does have an impact for councils looking to build public infrastructure. The other point that I wanted to make in relation to Channel Highway, I get that the frustration is that we continue to not do this project, and I had a photo for the Chronicle where I'm standing there saying we're going to build it this year, we promise, and we're not building it this year, so I'm personally exposed to it. But I'm excited by the fact that the reason we're not doing it is because we are having a proper look. We're not just going to rebuild the Channel Highway. The consultant is talking about making this a street and not a... Geez, Councillor Grace, it's interesting when other people are speaking that you're happy to interrupt and go into your own discussion, but you're so offended by it while you're speaking.
Yeah.
Thanks. I am, thanks. Thanks, Councillor Grace. So for all those reasons, I'm happy with the report. I get the frustration. Thanks, Councillor Grace. Yeah, thanks. I'm interested. Okay. I've had enough. Councillor West, would you like to sum up?
No, just to point out, I guess, in relation to the Channel Highway, that I also think it is worth waiting to do it properly. And the report in front of us does say that a replacement allocation for the Channel Highway works is included or will be included within Council's future budgets. And I think that is the expectation around the table, that if we're taking that money out of the capital program for reallocation this year, that it will certainly be included as an allocation going forward. Thank you.
Okay. The motion is moved by Councillor Westwood and seconded by Councillor Fox, is that Council note the current annual budget mid-year review and agree to reallocate $1.32 million within the existing capital program to other projects as follows. John Street reconstruction, $290,000. Tolone Avenue reconstruction, $250,000. Brightwater Road Stage 1 works, $75,000. Tabers Road, Stormwater, $120,000, and Future Design Project, $60,000. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? We'll have a division. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillor Street, Bastone, Westwood, Fox, Cordova, Midgley, Wass and Winter, and those against is Councillor Grace. The motion is carried. The next item is the boat shed leases, Nebraska Beach, Dens Point. It's a recommendation on page 142. Would someone like to move? Councillor Grace moves, seconded by Councillor Fox. Councillor Grace.
Look, I'm quite happy with this. I guess applicant, it just worries me a little bit. It says subject to there being no objections received during the public notice period, and be mindful that these objections need to be, I believe, strong objections, and they need to be people within the site, not elsewhere, which we get sometimes. But I'm quite happy with the procedures and the lease for that period of time.
Councillor Westwood.
I just had a question. In the report it says signs will be placed on each of the boat sheds giving notice to occupiers that they need to contact Council to make the appropriate arrangements to formalise their ongoing usage of the structures. Why would we not write to the actual ratepayer as opposed to just putting a sign up on their boat shed?
I assume it's a statutory requirement, Mr. Smee.
Mayor, it is a statutory requirement. I don't believe these are currently paying rates on each of their boat sheds, so the details of all the owners are not known.
So what would happen then if someone didn't see the sign on their boat shed, if they were away for a period of time, is there any consequence to them not actioning what might be in the notice?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, it's my understanding there's only one of the boat sheds where we don't know the owner. I guess what we've suggested in the report is that we take reasonable steps in which to determine who the owner is, but at some point in time you have to draw a line in the sand.
Councillor Fox.
I'm quite confident that this has been well put together. I note, though, that there are terms of 30 and 50-year leases here which are considerable, but the cost probably of those leases wouldn't provide that much revenue to council. But I'm also concerned that at the expiration of this period, it's proposed that the sheds be removed. Is there any opportunity at the end of that period, 50 years or 30 years hence, for the applicant to renew? Or is this a deliberate ploy promoted maybe by Crown Lands to try and remove buildings from the foreshore? Or do we think by then it'll be underwater?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, it is a deliberate clause we put in. This is now public land upon which there is in effect a private asset, and of course the option open to council, having now acquired that land, is to require the removal of these sheds. But we believe it's only fair and reasonable that the current owners be given an opportunity to continue their use, but there needs to be a sunset clause, and so the timeframe suggested is that sunset clause, and we believe at the end of the use by the current owners, the sheds should be removed and the land then can be fully utilised as the public, as it is now public land.
Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, broadly agree with the recommendation and the comments that have been made and those in the report. Just a question. Leases to be non-transferable. Obviously, that means we're going to prohibit an assignment. What about in circumstances where the lessee dies?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor. The intent of that clause is that a lease cannot be sold. They would be transferable within the family, but not outside of the family.
Thank you. The only other question that I've got is just in relation to, I don't have any problem with the reduction in rental for the previous owners of the land, given the fact that they've given us over and above the public open space that was required. The change in term seems slightly inequitable to me, though. Was that an arrangement that was made prior to the space being transferred, or the land being transferred to council, or are we just being good guys and gals?
This is me.
Through you, Mayor. The negotiations with the previous landowner have been quite protracted, and the 50-year term was one that they were not prepared to budge on, and bearing in mind they needed to sign the transfer of the title to us, and in turn we did compromise and indicate that our recommendation to council would be four 10-year options rather than the two that would be offered to everyone else.
Thanks.
There are no other lights on. Councillor Grace, would you like to sum up? Okay, the motion is moved by Councillor Grace, seconded by Councillor Fox, is that subject to there being no objections received during the public notice period, the General Manager be authorised to negotiate lease agreements with the occupiers of boat sheds on the foreshore of Nebraska Beach based on the following terms and conditions. 1, a term of 10 years applied to all boat shed occupiers with 2 further 10-year options except for the previous owners of the land who will be offered a further 4-year options. 2, a rental of $200 per annum to apply, adjusted by CPI each year, except for the previous owners of land to whom the annual rental will be $10. 3, lessees be fully responsible for the boat sheds, including their removal at the end of the agreement. And 4, leases to be non-transferable. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against, motion is carried unanimously. Next item is the purchasing policy 3.7. There's a recommendation on page 145. Thanks. Anyone like to move the recommendation on page 145? Maybe someone hasn't moved anything tonight. Let's vary it up. Keep them guessing. Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Cordova. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Move the recommended motion. The policy complies with the Act and best practice and continues to do so. No significant changes, few significant changes to the code, and all of those are good ones. Particularly note that we've made some changes to recognise that we probably aren't tendering by post very much anymore, which is pleasing.
Good. Any further comments or questions? Councillor Bastone.
Thank you. On page 160, 4.14b, Council must not consider a non-conforming tender unless it is unless it meets the requirements set out in the tender package for a conforming or an alternative tender. Then if you go across to 4.15c, Council may accept any conforming tender, any non-conforming tender, or any alternative tender. But on 4.14 it says it must not consider it. So I don't understand how the two go together.
Here's the order. Who are we going to hear? Mr. Breen? Mr. Rowley?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Sorry, I haven't got the printed agenda, so I'm just trying to reconcile the clause numbers. Thanks for that question. They're both supposed to protect us and what we're allowed to do, and the slight difference between them is, as you'll notice, we've changed to the definition of the alternative tender. Previously we only had conforming and non-conforming, and that basically excluded people with technical innovation from submitting a tender that didn't fully conform with all the technical requirements as well as all the other ones, unless they submitted a conforming tender and then a non-conforming one in conjunction. What that effectively meant that someone that couldn't entirely comply with technical requirements because they had an innovative technical solution weren't able to tender for us. So as a result of that, we've got these, the idea of this is to make sure that we don't fall foul or get challenged as doing something that wasn't practical. So the one clause is saying that we shouldn't consider the non-conforming one. The second one is in there to avoid us being challenged if we have something that someone wants to argue is non-conforming that we've actually judged to be alternative. So there's always with tendering and contracts, there's always a legal opinion and it's not a black and white. So we tend to want to make sure that we don't have anything that someone can say, well, you've accepted a non-conforming tender but we do consider alternatives, which someone might argue is an alternative they might argue is non-conforming. So it's a little bit complicated.
Mm. It does look very complicated and it looks contradictory, but I'm sure legal people don't find it that way, just ordinary people.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. Two very quick questions. The first one is on, I'm looking at 4.15i, and so this is, you could either see it on page 161 in the track changes, or you can see it on 174 in the track changes. Just a quick question, why did we decide to remove the requirement for a formal contract? That's my question, my first question.
Mr. Rowley. So it's 4.5.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Can I just read the removal?
Yes, I'll read out what was taken out. It says...
Yes, it's actually a duplication. We've actually subsequently say that they must execute a formal contract. So that one was really a duplication because there's a later clause that says they must do it.
No problem.
It was just extra words.
Yep, thank you. My apologies for that, a redundant question. My hopefully non-redundant question is about 2.4 in the objectives, which says that if there's any inconsistency between this code and any conditions of tendering contained in a tender package, so I'm looking now at page 156 in the track changes one, it then says... So if there's any inconsistency between this code and the tender package, conditions of tendering contained in the tender package will prevail to the extent of the inconsistency. And I just wanted a bit more clarification as to... initially, when I read it, I thought, well, doesn't that just mean that you'll follow the code unless you don't want to, in which case you don't have to follow the code? I just wanted a bit more clarity around...
Mr. Rowley.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, understand the point. I think it's really, you'll notice in a couple of other areas that we've put precedence in where there are discrepancies. The code is a general document which applies to pretty well every tender that we do above the prescribed amount. There are certain circumstances where there might be some specific detail that could be interpreted from the code that wasn't relevant or was contrary to what we were trying to achieve on that one. So it was really just to make sure that we'd set an order of precedence so that if we have a specific requirement of a specific tender, that it's clear where, and we define that in the request for tender document, it's clear that that's where the precedent is. And someone can't say we've been unfairly treated because you've said you'll do this in the code, which is a generic statement. The specific request will cover the specifics of that tender.
Thank you. Just a question about the multiple use register. Do we have any multiple use registers and what are they?
Mr. Rowley.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. No, we don't currently use multiple use registers. We're not really large enough to establish panels. We would generally just do quotes on a individual needs basis.
Councillor Grace.
When a tender makes inquiries, it may be one tender that raises a very valid point. I assume that all the tenders would be notified of that, even though one person picked it up. That's one question.
Mr. Rowley?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, that's one of the really big advantages we have of moving across to electronic tendering portals is that as soon as anyone, if someone asks a question, we require them to ask through the electronic tendering portal, the forum on there, and as soon as a response is provided, every person that's downloaded the request documents is notified of the response and able to access it.
The other question I have is on your tender form, once that's submitted, which gives you a total of your tender, that should be final, is that right?
Mr. Rowling.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Generally it is. We would actually state on the tender form, we'd look at each particular one and determine what was appropriate. We do a number of tenders for example, term contracts where they're schedule of rates, and we do others where we might look and say, well, in this particular instance, the lump sum amount isn't necessarily the tender. We would have a statement in the tender form that says where there's a discrepancy, which one prevails. But generally, it would be the lump sum. But there are occasions where it's not. It's clearly stated on the tender form.
I asked that question because I know that one tenderer had his tender form sent back and he was allowed to alter it after the tender's closed.
Is there a question? Mr. Rowley, would you like to answer that?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. I don't know about that particular one. We do get occasions where the evaluation team will find discrepancies between when you add up what's in the breakdown of prices and the tender total. There are sometimes discrepancies because of errors that have occurred in arithmetical errors or Excel spreadsheet errors, and under those circumstances we would apply what we'd said on the tender form in terms of which one prevailed. So if we'd said that the rates prevailed and there was an error in a tender price, we would then allow correction of the total because the tender was effectively the submitted rates and the total was the arithmetical total of the submitted tendered rates.
Yeah, I mean, that's changed a bit because when I tendered, your tender price on the bottom was your price, and if you made an add and up mistake, you had one choice, that's to withdraw your tender, not to alter your tender. Just on another note here, your fixed price tenders. That amazes me, fixed price. We go out, we call a tender, we want fixed prices. How can they be fixed prices unless they design and construct themselves? Because if it's a fixed price on a drawing done by a consultant or council, it would be not feasible to ask somebody to tender on a fixed price, one would think.
Mr. Rowley.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. What the fixed price is for the defined scope of work that a tenderer could reasonably interpret from the drawings and specifications provided to him. So it's quite normal, and all of the AS contracts, AS 4000, AS 4902, used to be 2124 in the old days, the construction contracts, they all provide for lump sum or fixed price tenders, and they also define the way in which any variations will be valued and what constitutes a variation. So the fixed price tender is a standard format in the construction industry here and overseas, and it's for what the scope of work against which the tenderer submitted it was. And if there's a variation for things that they couldn't understand and they're not taking the risk on that, then there's methodology for variation in the general conditions of contract. So fixed price tenders is quite common practice and legitimate the way we do it, hopefully.
So you still have a schedule of rates, so you can
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Yes, we have a schedule of rates which is actually defined as a breakdown of prices. We call it a schedule of rates, but clearly state that it's a breakdown of if it's a fixed price tender, lump sum tender, the schedule of rates is a breakdown for valuation purposes and for valuing variations and valuing payments. But the contracts are clear that it is a breakdown. It's not an additional schedule of rates if it's a lump sum or fixed price tender.
And just one other question. Do you still have in your contracts that the council can't alter a tender by 10% or whatever?
Mr. Rowley.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. No, we don't have have that, because there's a couple of aspects to it. The first one is the superintendent, who's actually nominated as the independent party to determine variations, can't be restricted by a council policy. So contractually, they have to agree to whatever the contract says. So to put a 10% restriction on would potentially be putting the superintendent in a compromising position. What we generally do is, when we put the recommendation up for approval, it's put up with a 10% contingency amount, with an expectation that we would come back with a report to obtain more money if the 10% was going to be exceeded, except in an emergency. And I guess an emergency in that circumstance would be if the superintendent was legally obliged under the contract to agree a further amount. We couldn't make that subject to council approval. It would have to be a report afterwards, otherwise we'd be putting the superintendent in a compromising position.
Just I didn't quite understand the whole lot, but I won't ask for it, but my question really was, say we let a tender for $200,000 and then we find that the water main's okay or something's okay, so we don't need to spend that money. How much can council reduce the contract amount,
Mr. Rowley?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. The contract under the standard forms of contract, the contract can be varied up or down, and there are provisions for what varying downwards, what's taken out and what you're allowed to put in, and the superintendent is required to make a determination of what the change in price is. But yes, you can reduce it as much as possible, but proportionately it'll probably cost you a lot more because of the allowance for profit which the contract is allowed to retain from the original contract.
No other lights on. Councillor Street, would you like to sum up? Okay, the motion was moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Cordova. And it's the council approves the updated policy 3.7 purchasing policy and updated policy 3.12 code for tenders and contracts as attached to this report. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried. I should also say for the record that Councillor Midgley left the meeting at 7:41 and then returned at 7:41. Councillor Westwood left the meeting at 7:50 and then returned at 7:52. And Councillor Grace has just left us at 7:57 p.m. And I'm sure he'll return soon. Next item. Would anyone like a break? Given Councillor Fox would like a break. And we have been going for a long time. In the interest of everyone's OH&S, I think we should. What about we just go... Thanks, Councillor Street. It's just 7 minutes, is that enough? So we'll come back at 8:05 p.m. As promised, we're back. We've got a quorum. And the next item is the petition on the hydrotherapy pool. Recommendation on page 181. Someone like to move? Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Westwood. Councillor Fox.
Well, it's been a fantastic community effort to get so many signatures on this petition, and I think it's a very important concept of having a hydrotherapy pool. And if we look at this as part of the feasibility study into the development of the Aquatic Centre for Kingborough, which we are considering at the moment, then in due course, hopefully, it will become a reality. Thank you.
Yes, I was just going to say there is, in fact, a warm water hydrotherapy pool in Kingborough, which is used by the people who live down south. It's at Woodbridge. Centre of the universe, Woodbridge does already have one. So perhaps they should be saying a hydrotherapy pool for Kingston, not Kingborough, because we do have one.
All right, there's no other lights on, and in the interest of time, we're going to move on unless we get a light.
Okay, the motion, as moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Westwood, is that the organiser of the petition calling for the sourcing of a hydrotherapy pool be advised that Council will consider this matter as part of a feasibility study into the development of an aquatic facility for Kingborough. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried. Next item is the blowhole reserve fencing. There's a recommendation on page 183. Would someone like to move the recommendation? Councillor Watts, seconded by Councillor Midgley. Councillor Watts.
I have no qualms with this one, Mayor, providing, of course, that the authors of the report were aware that that might be the case, so happy to support it.
Councillor Fox.
I might have to move an amendment because I feel that this issue was reported to Council in closed session, and a report was provided by staff which we now cannot make public, and there may be variances between our own officer's position and those put by IPM or Bill Cromer, but particularly IPM. And we can't discuss that with the community, even though many members of the community already realise what was in that report from our professional officer, because they've spoken directly with that professional officer. And I think in the interest of openness and transparency, I think it's important that we do include that document as well, to provide a balance to these two reports. Well, if I get agreement, it could be included with the motion, and otherwise I would put an amendment.
So you're asking agreement from the mover and seconder to add the report, to publicly release the IPM consulting assessment, the closed session report, and the bill. The general manager is begging me to provide some advice.
I have discussed this with Mr. Smee, so yeah.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, Councillor Fox, I would caution against an amendment that would see the report that went to closed session being released publicly. The report that went to closed session was put in closed session under 15.2i of the Local Government Meeting Procedure Regulations. 15.2i refers to existing or possible litigation, and nothing has changed in that regard.
I had Councillor Grace next on my list.
Look, I think the recommendation says is to release the IPM and the consultant assessment by Bill Cromer. I mean, that's what the people of Blackmans Bay, as I understand, ask for. They've asked for no more. And that's what we're going to vote tonight, to give them that information. Happy with that.
Councillor Westwood.
I would like to ask whether councillors have been provided with a copy of the Bill Cromer geotechnical report.
Yes, we got emailed on Friday by Ms. Tollemore.
Do we?
Yes.
Yep. Right. Okay. Well, nonetheless, the decision that Council made, and I note that when we did discuss this, we talked about transferring it from the from closed session into open session, but we received advice, I think because it dealt with the costing and a few things like that, that we couldn't. But the decision that Council has made on that night in closed session was based not on the Bill Cromer geotechnical report. It was based on the advice in the IPM consulting risk assessment. And given the decision was made on the information contained in the risk assessment report, I don't think that we should be releasing the Bill Cromer geotechnical report, because it didn't contribute to the decision making of councillors in the council meeting. I'm aware that some residents have concerns about the height of the fence that was determined in closed session. That height was based on advice we received as part of the risk assessment, and I think it's therefore appropriate that we release the risk assessment, but I'm not convinced that we should be releasing the Bill Cromer geotechnical report, because it didn't form part of our decision making. So I would be asking the mover and the seconder if we could amend the current recommendation to remove reference to the Bill Cromer geotechnical report.
Before you do that, the General Manager again was begging to provide advice. General Manager.
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Councillor Westwood, only to say that, as all councillors are aware, following council's decision to install a fence at a request from local residents, council's urban designer Paul Donnelly and myself attended an on-site meeting. There were approximately 20 in attendance. The meeting lasted for an hour and a half. I was asked on two occasions, could the residents get a copy of the risk assessment? I took that question on notice, and one of the reasons I took it on notice was because I didn't know whether the authors of the report would be prepared to release it publicly. We made contact with them, and they, of course, agreed. Otherwise, this recommendation wouldn't be before council tonight. And the reason that Paul and I, although I'm the author of the report, also saw fit to recommend to council tonight that Mr. Cromer's geotech report be publicly released is that the two do talk to each other, and I think it's fair to say that we preempted that if I didn't do that in my report, I would probably have a follow-up report at the next council meeting with a recommendation that it be released on the basis that it does talk to the risk assessment report.
Do you still want to ask the mover and seconder?
Yes.
Thought so?
Yes.
Councillor Ross...
Can I ask a question as well?
Well, we'll just deal with this and then... Oh, okay, look, if it's relevant, let's hear it.
Why wasn't that included originally? The two councillors, this report, the geotechnical report. Do we receive? Is that the one we received?
The Bill Cromer. Yes. So the question, General Manager, is why was the Bill Cromer geotechnical report not included in the agenda papers?
I've just checked. I didn't receive it on Friday. So it was from Amanda and not from Town Planning.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, it's difficult for me, Councillor Midgley, to answer that question, except to say that what I've already made public, and I'd have to refer you back to the original report to answer the question.
Well, so hang on. Yeah, hang on, now I'm with you. Yeah, so the question is, why is the Bill Cromer report not included in the agenda papers? Yeah. Is that the question? Yeah, the reason is because we haven't resolved to make it public yet.
Correct.
Yeah. Yep. Sorry, I should have had. That was my fault.
Yeah.
I guess it'd be hard to, because we're dealing with the item in open session, it'd be hard to put an attachment in closed session. When it was originally resolved. Okay.
We didn't have it.
We didn't have it. That's correct. We didn't have it. It didn't exist. Its non-existence was an issue. Okay. Well said.
So just another question then. Yeah. So we're being asked to release a report that we didn't have at the time that we made the decision on the fence height.
Yeah.
So why is it therefore relevant that we release a report that we didn't even have?
General Manager or Mr. Smee. Mr. Smee, you want to have a crack?
The IPM report that was discussed in closed session did indeed reference the fact that there would need to be cross-referencing with a geotech report in relation to the fence footings, and we did flag in the report that any recommendations relating to the IMP report did need to be qualified by getting that further geotechnical advice. So that was flagged in that report, and as the General Manager has said, the two are linked.
Do you still want to ask the mover and seconder? So do you want to... What do you want to ask exactly, sorry?
You want to ask the mover and seconder if they'd be happy to remove the reference to the Bill Cromer report in the motion? Is that correct? Councillor Wass? And that's the end of that. You can move an amendment later on, though, if you like. I think Councillor Cordova wanted to make a contribution.
Yes, I just thought I would give it my contribution. Thank you, Mayor, through you. I think it's important to just maximise transparency where possible, and I'm fully cognisant of what the General Manager has stated, and I think it's very prudent of the General Manager to state that where matters relate to litigation, it's important to take a cautious approach. But in this case, when it comes to the Bill Cromer geotechnical report, there's clearly no risk there, there's no risk there. So I think we should, because there's such big community interest in this particular case, and I think it's important that I go on the public record talking about how I think that the way that this fencing is moving forward, I don't think that it should have gone to 6 foot high or 1.8 metres. I don't think that was an appropriate way forward.
Point of order, we're not talking about the height of the fence. We're talking about releasing the report.
Yep, okay, sorry, I withdraw that. So I just really think that transparency is a really fundamental principle when it comes to representative democracy. I think it's people will be fascinated and interested, and people care deeply about this issue, so I think they will benefit from reading the report. That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other contributions to be made? Councillor Fox, did you want to continue with your... You were thinking about an amendment. You're happy?
I have great respect for Mr. Smee and Mr. Arnold's opinion, but like Councillor Cordova, I think the interest of transparency and openness is very important, particularly because many of the community already know what's in this report directly from the General Manager and from Mr. Our own professional landscaping expert, and that those concerns may well be at variance with the other reports, but I think if they see everything in the context of all the information that we've received and that we've based our decision on, it's going to be easier for the community to understand where we're coming from and the fact that it isn't just a black and white issue. In a way, everything's moderated by professional opinions. And I like many issues that come before us, we get many varied points of view from professional people, and we have to steer our way through this and come up with a political decision as well as a technical response. And I think it's very important that we include the actual report that I don't really see. It should have gone into closed session, even though, I mean, we always have to be careful of litigation, but in this situation we might actually be causing more harm in the community by not having the facts on the table. So I would like to move an amendment that we also include the report to council that we went to council in closed session on this issue.
So what about after the word assessment, we just put the closed session report, yes, comma, after the word assessment, comma, the closed session report. Does that satisfy,
yes,
what you're talking about, Gina? Is that correct? And you also want to provide some advice, I think, didn't you? GM's keen to provide some more advice.
Through you, Mr. Mayor, only to say two things, if I may, Councillor Fox. Firstly, to repeat my strong caution of earlier, that the report was placed in closed under 15.2i for reasons that have not changed. And secondly, just to respond to your statement that many of the residents know what's already in the report. That is not factual. During the 1.5 hour meeting that Paul and I attended on site, the only thing that we were at liberty to say was that the council had resolved to install fencing, and we had to stick to that script for a number of reasons. I took their question on notice about access to the risk assessment report, and I followed that up as I said I would. Hence this report tonight.
So Councillor Fox has suggested an amendment. We've been looking for a seconder in order to debate it. Councillor Cordova seconds it. Councillor Fox, did you want to speak to the amendment?
I did meet on site with one of the residents who told me that they were aware that there had been consideration for a 1.5 or 1.2 metre fence, and also that there was consideration for a fence on the southern side of the property, which I don't know how he would have found that out, but that's what he said. And he said that he had also met with Paul Donnelly and Mr. Gary Arnold. So I'm well aware that there are a very passionate group down there who really see the details and want to know the details, but at the same time they also accept the details when they have the facts before them. So I would like to recommend that we support this amendment. Thank you.
I'm not actually sure which line. Councillor Street was first. Councillor Street.
I just have a question, Mayor. I'm wondering whether Mr. Smee can remind us of the reasoning behind this being in closed session in the first place.
Mr. Smee.
Through the Chair, there have been incidents in the past that there has been both media and social media commentary in relation to Council's role in contributing to those incidents. So the potential for litigation against Council remains a possibility. The content of the report discussed matters that related distinctly to Council's role in terms of the provision of fencing, the standard of fencing, and they would be very much central to any case against Council. And in accordance with the local government meeting procedures, it was appropriate that that be listed in closed session.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. I obviously realise that we need to tread very carefully, because nobody wants to make a habit of releasing things that rightly should be in closed session onto the public record. And so, for that matter, I understand why we're being urged to be cautious here. In this case, I feel that on balance, looking at the report, that I don't feel that... and look, it must be said that I'm not a lawyer, and I'm fully cognisant that there are always risks of litigation that are associated with anything that's contentious or sensitive. I think in this case, the test for me is whether or not there's significant public concern. And initially, I have to be honest that I thought that the reason why it was held in closed council session was to do with financial implications rather than, and you know, not jeopardising council's decision when it came to tenders. I didn't realise that it was that was to do with legal sensitivities. My feeling in this case, whilst I do recognise that we obviously don't want to be making a habit of revealing closed council things to the public, in this case, I think on balance, the community interest in this particular issue warrants us doing so on this occasion, and so that's why I've seconded this motion. Thanks.
Well, the agenda of that particular council meeting listed the confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session, including the blowhole reserve risk mitigations, and reference the correct section. So the advice was available to you both in a written form. The other thing that I recollect from that meeting is that Councillor Westwood, when we discussed transfer of items, actually questioned that, and I think a number of other items, as to why they couldn't be held in open session. And the answer from Mr. Smee at that time was pretty similar to what he's just said. And on that advice, the council decided to continue to deal with this in closed session. All of us did that. So the idea that you didn't want to discuss it in open session in December, but in January it's very important that it all be in open, is a bit bizarre. It doesn't stack up, doesn't make any sense. The other concern I've got about this is that there's sort of an insinuation here. Anyone listening to the tape would think that in the report contains some sort of mind-blowing, you know, piece of information that you know, is going to be of great interest to people. There really isn't. I don't think there's anything in there that's going to be going to change anyone's mind about the decision. What the information, the primary source of evidence is actually in the risk report, which is the most important report that I think should be released. And that's why I opposed the amendment. I think we got advice to say that there's litigation issues. We accepted the advice on the 9th of December. Nothing has changed. If you didn't want to just debate it in open session in December, then you shouldn't be prepared to open it up in January because 20 people contacted the general manager. I think it's important that we deal with the request. The request is for the primary evidence, not for the secondary evidence in the report, which doesn't say a lot anyway. Any other comments on the amendment? Councillor Westwood.
Just to echo the sentiments of the Mayor, that I did try and bring this into open session of Council when we debated it, and based on the advice from Mr Smee, determined at that point in time that it wouldn't be appropriate, and I still believe that that advice is sound, so I won't support the amendment.
Councillor Grace.
I won't support the amendment because it's not what the people of Blackmans Bay want anyway. They just want what's written up there. And I believe that the information I have been told by a lot of people that rang me and emailed me, they're quite happy on the recommendation by the general manager. And there it is in front of us. And I won't be voting for the closed session stuff release.
Councillor Cordova, did you have a question?
Yeah, it was a question just about... It's tricky because you can't discuss the closed
yes.
thing. But my question is there anything within that closed council report which is not of a sensitive nature which would help inform people in addition to what is already made available by the geotechnical report and the IPM consulting? And it's a leading question because I think that there is a couple of things that are not of a sensitive risk litigation
well,
nature.
That's an objective question. I mean, that's up to you. We can't selectively release certain parts of a report. It either gets released or it doesn't. And that's the only question here. Did you want to sum up, Councillor Fox? Okay, the amendment is on the screen, just for the record. It's to add the words, the closed session report, following the word assessment in the original motion. It's moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Have a division. All those in favour, please raise your hands. Councillor Fox and Cordova. And those against is Councillors Grace, Street, Bastone, Westwood, Midgley, Wass and Winter. The amendment is lost. We're back on the substantive motion. I've had speakers... is that right? Fox, Grace, Westwood, Bastone and Cordova. Anyone else wish to speak? Councillor Street.
I haven't spoken
on it. No, I didn't say you do it.
Yes, you did.
Oh, did I? Sorry.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, I'll be voting for the motion and the release of both reports. I have no issue with the IPM risk assessment being released. Obviously, that was the basis of part of our decision, as well as our own views on it and the views of the community and what we thought was expected of us as well. And I have no issue with releasing the Bill Cromer geotechnical report, even though it wasn't given to us at the time, for the simple reason that one of them is a risk report and one of them is a geotechnical report in relation to the implementation of whatever decision we make. Really, that's, you know, that's all there is to it. There's not going to be anything earth-shattering in the geotechnical report that matters in terms of council's decision in relation to the height of the fence, the location of the fence, or our assessment of the risk assessment. That's a terrible use of the English language, but you know what I mean. So I will be supporting the recommended motion.
Further speakers, would you like to sum up? Councillor Wass.
Thank you, Mayor. I see this as the community seeking information. They've asked for certain information. The General Manager has ensured that both IPM and Cromer are happy and comfortable with that information, which they've responded in the affirmative. The General Manager has made a recommendation. We can now deliver that, and I fully endorse the recommendation that we should now resolve to public release the reports as printed.
Okay, the motion, as moved by Councillor Wallace and seconded by Councillor Midgley, is the Council resolved to release publicly the IPM Consulting Risk Assessment and the Bill Cromer Geotechnical Report. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? Over division. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillors Grace, Street, Bastone, Fox, Cordova, Midgley and Wallace. And those against is Councillor Westwood. It's three times tonight, Councillor Westwood. It's very impressive. Okay, the next item is the Councillor's Expenses and Provision of Facilities Policy as a recommendation on page 185. Someone like to move it? Lack of enthusiasm. Councillor Fox moved, seconded by... Jeepers. Seconded by Councillor Grace. Councillor Fox.
I don't think there are many changes, actually. There's a few about... the devices, portable devices, it's more to do with language than anything, and giving people, removing some of the alternative arrangements that could otherwise have been useful in the past but have now been superseded by technology, and also the fact that any facilities must be returned to council if they're not purchased at the end of the councillor's term. So I think it's fairly well business as usual. Thank you.
Councillor Bastone.
There's one very important section deleted from the policy, and it quite worries me, and that is that at the moment you can have a council computer or your agenda printed. Now it means that you'll be able to have a council computer, a council printer, council stationery, and have council produce the agenda and print it for you and send it to you. Now, I think this is sort of eating your cake and or having your cake and eating it too. I think it's one or the other. If you want your agenda printed, then you don't have a council computer. And I will be voting against this motion because that area has been deleted. Sorry, it's on page 188 in the where it's being changed, and it's item 6.3.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
I thought our printers, or I don't know what other councillors do, but I have quite a few people in the community to come to my house and ask if I could print stuff off, what particularly do with community events or community fundraising, stuff like that. And I print them off for them. Not thousands, but, you know, I do print them off some as they request. I mean, I thought that's part of our role. Has our role changed so much in the last year or so, or what? It seems to me nowadays that we don't need to do anything for the community. Just rock up here and when the community come to us, tell them to go away.
So Councillor Bastone hadn't finished. I thought your question might have been... You're still welcome to make... That was just a question. You're still welcome to make a contribution later. I'll continue with Councillor Bastone's contribution.
I just wanted to actually say to Councillor Grace, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have the printers and that we shouldn't use them. I'm saying that if we have a printer and a council computer, we should not get the agenda printed by Mrs. Morton. We should do one or the other.
Sorry, this is me. This is what happens when it gets a bit late. I'm going to switch back on here. Apologies. Councillor Grace, you're not next, though. Can you put your light on so that I know you're waiting? Okay, your light's not working. I'll note it down here.
There are three other lights.
Yes, that's right. That's why I didn't want to... So Councillor Westwood, I think, is next.
Thank you. I just had a question about travelling expenses to and from the meetings of council. is that consistent with other... municipalities, that they'll pay councillors to travel to and from council meetings?
the answer is, are you asking whether councillors can claim for petrol to and from a council meeting?
No, it seems like councillors can claim to travel to and from a council
meeting. And they do, yes. There are councillors that claim for that at the moment.
But is that consistent with other councils? Or is that an extra thing that we have?
It's me. I'm pretty sure it's in the Act somewhere that we are required to pay reasonable expenses for travel. So it would be consistent with other councils.
Okay. I guess it's my contribution. Don't think that councillors should be claiming to travel to and from meetings of council. That's just part of our job, isn't it? No one else. No, staff don't get paid to travel to work.
There's a can of worms here that I don't think we should open. But anyway, Councillor Midgley, you're next.
Thank you, Mayor. I also have a couple of questions relating to the vehicle allowance. Sorry, I'm just finding where my questions are. I'm just wondering, does this vehicle allowance cover bus travel, motorbikes or bicycles?
Mr. Smee, Mr. Breen.
Through the chair, I guess the way it operates is that it's a cost reimbursement sort of process. So for travelling purposes, we use the Australian Tax Office rates per kilometre. So we are able to pick that up. If someone travelled by bus and had a bus ticket, then clearly we'd reimburse that. Motorbikes and things like e-bikes or bikes in general, there's no Australian Tax Office reimbursement rate, of my understanding at the moment. So until there is one, I guess there's no independent means of coming up with a rate per kilometre for reimbursement.
Thank you. I did do a little bit of research at other councils, and I know, I think it was City of Port Phillip had I think it was 30 cents, and I don't know, if it must not be ATO, but yeah, they had a 30 cents, I think, allowance for bicycle allowance and 30 cents for motorbikes. But just in the response regarding the bus travel, I don't see anywhere in the policy that it does cover for a councillor. We're wanting the public and everybody to move towards other alternative transport options other than vehicles. It feels very vehicle dominated. Could you point me to in the policy, whereas if I caught a bus to a meeting in Hobart that was council related, where in the policy does it state that I could actually get my metro log and perhaps claim that with council?
4.1,
I feel like.
That's from the general manager, by the way. I just repeated what he said to me. Do you want to explain, GM?
Through you, Mr. Mayor. Councillor Midgley, as my colleague, Mr. Breen, has already indicated, the policy is such that whilst the reference has to pertain to current ATO rulings and guidelines, there is also sufficient scope in the policy at 4.1 for council officers to remit any bus voucher or similar car parking tickets for bona fide expenses under this policy.
Okay, thank you.
Councillor Grace, you're next, I think.
Landed with having a computer, and Mr. Morton, I couldn't come to a council meeting without a hard copy.
Mm. Yeah, so I think under the policy as proposed here, you are still able to have a computer and a printer at home and a printed agenda, is that correct, General Manager? Councillor Grace is still going to be able, Mr. Breen, Councillor Grace is still going to be able to get a printed agenda and...
Yes, through the chair. Essentially, we're moving to portable devices and we'd like to move away from printing agendas, but understand it's not practical for everyone at the moment. So there'll be further consideration of that in a policy outside of this particular policy. So it'll be part of an ICT policy that will be put into place down the track.
Councillor Midgley.
I have a question again, just relating to e-bikes or bicycles. If
I understand it's not part of the ATO, so our policy is directly related to what the ATO covers. Could perhaps at a future time I ask for a motion to include e-bikes as part of this travel policy? Sorry, this expenses policy?
Yes, through the chair. So it's certainly something that we could look at in the future, and we just have to do some sort of analysis on cost, because essentially this policy is around cost reimbursement. So as long as we're confident that it's a cost reimbursement outcome, then that could be included within this policy and something we could look at in the next 6 months.
Yes, I suggested to council immediately that we should allow for to be reimbursed for green cards to encourage us to use the bus more than cars. And then when I spoke to council immediately today on the phone, I realised that, in fact, we already were able to reimburse ourselves for using the bus, and I'll try and do that myself. A lot of the time when I'm travelling in the mayor's car, I'm just driving into town for a meeting and then driving back, so it's actually easier to get the bus. So I should do that. I guess we should all try. Councillor Mitchell, you can't be compensated for hitchhiking, though, so... Councillor Fox, would you like to... would you like to summarise?
No, it's been a good discussion, and I, as Mr Breen says, we need to keep it practical, and I'm looking forward to a further report on some of the details, but I think this is a generally acceptable position. Thank you.
The motion is moved by Councillor Fox, seconded by Councillor Grace, is that Council approves Policy 2.1 on Council's expenses and provision of facilities policy as attached to this report. All those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against? No. We'll have a division. All those in favour, please raise your hand. Councillors Grace, Street, Westwood, Fox, Cordova, Midgley, Wass and Winter. And those against? Councillor Bastone. Motion's carried. The next item is the information reports, and there's a recommended motion on page 195. Would someone like to move? Councillor Westwood, seconded by Councillor Wass. First item is the financial report for 1 July to 31 December. Usually a big thing, but we've already kind of talked about this, haven't we? Councillor Westwood.
I just had a couple of questions. I think Mr. Breen was glad it was a long weekend. The under cash balances, uncommitted funds, the change from November to December, November's $4.5 million down to $402,000 in December. I'm just wondering why or where, you know, the $4.1 million was committed.
Mr. Breen.
You're through the chair. Essentially around the end of December we have a significant inflow of invoices from contractors, so primarily it was payments out, a couple of large ones in regards to some capital works that are underway at the moment. So in January we get an inflow of rates, the third rate instalment comes in January, so the numbers have been, the cash available, the cash funds has increased in January.
Thank you. And I know this has been the same balance in the reserve, unexpended grants for the year, but I'm just wondering what grant or grants make up the $360,000 in the reserve for unexpended grants?
Mr. Brennan.
Yeah, through the chair, towards the end of last year we had a number of community resilience grants, essentially in regards to the floods and the outcomes of the floods and some of the studies that we needed to do to prevent flooding damage in the future. So they're all underway at the moment.
Councillor Grace.
Just a quick one, Mr. Breen.
Mm.
On page 219, you have operation income expenses on properties and emergency management. I don't see anything here, and it's small printing, but I don't see anything here for the Dennis Point Cafe.
Mr. Breen.
Through the chair, I think it'd be covered under the Dennis Point Hall, which is about halfway down the income line there.
What page, sir?
Dennis Point Hall under user fees.
Am I still talking about 219 page?
Yeah, page 219. Under income, there's user fees, and we've got all those rentals there. Rentals, Dens Point Hall, is a $10,000 amount against that.
Okay, it's in there, that's all. I couldn't see it.
There's no other lights on, so we're going to move on to the Governance and Community Services Quarterly Report, which starts on page 255. I'll give you a second to catch up. Councillor Midgley.
I'm going to get to their page.
Yeah, that's cool.
So it's great to have an update of the vast work that is done in this area. I'm just finding my notes now. Just looking at, sorry, I've got a few things highlighted. Just wondering about a couple of questions. The Community Resilience Working Group, I have heard that that group is folding due to the numbers being low, and I'm just wondering if there is an outcome of that. It's a bit disappointing. I haven't really seen it being promoted much to the community. Just wondering if we could have some more information around that.
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Midgley, you're correct. The numbers have been low in terms of attendance at meetings, and I know our Emergency Management Coordinator is reviewing whether that format is the best way of promoting community resilience, but I don't believe that she's reached a conclusion on that matter as yet.
Thank you. Just note as well, I've spoken to some local residents in Howden, or a local resident who's really driving the Howden the phone tree. That's really fantastic, and I understand that council staff are really significantly supporting in that. The Kingston CBD resilience programs. Have you? I'm just wondering. What does that mean?
Through you, Mayor, I'd need to take that one on notice and provide some further advice. I don't know the detail on that. Sorry.
Thank you. And just great to see there was a good response. 500 responses from the community survey after the May 2018 event. The stories of resilience. Actually, when I had my sound before, I was actually listening to one of those stories of resilience. I really recommend people listen to a couple of our community members sharing their story about after the flood, and I think it would be a really great local kind of public art opportunity actually to hear their stories being played, if of course everyone agreed to do that. But I note that it's on the Hobart Council website. Will that be coming, I guess, will that be promoted at all to our Kingborough Council website?
Yes, Mayor, that would be the intent.
Fantastic. We recently received an email from the Arts Officer, Carolyn Choi, in regards to the fantastic work that she's doing in that area. It's really, really wonderful to see the work that is happening in the art space. And well done to her. Just a couple of questions. So just in regards to the community hub, what is our sort of speculation for that? Are we on target for getting a number of hirers? Would we like to get more hirers? How do council staff think that we're tracking in regards to hiring of the community hub?
Through you, Mayor, councils will be aware that we are in the process of developing a marketing plan for the hub, and included in that marketing plan will be some targets with respect to hire rates. One of the difficulties we've had to date has been that the facility has only recently been completed, and in fact there are still some defects that need to be addressed. Those defects do impact on our ability to hire out the space, particularly in the forecourt area where the concrete is cracked and needs to be replaced. So we do need to be mindful of the impact of those future works on our bookings, and of course the delay in getting the NBN to the to the facility has impacted on our ability to hire out the co-working space. So we are behind with respect to where we thought we would be, but they're due to works that have been outside our control and certainly outside the control of the hub coordinator. But generally speaking, we're reasonably happy with the rate of hire we've received so far, and the feedback we've received from hirers has been very positive.
Councillor Bastow.
I just want to point out an inconsistency on page 264 and 265. 10.5, the community hub now has NBN connection, etc., etc. 10.6, the NBN is not connected. So I'm sure we can't have it both ways, but it's in the same report.
Thank you, Mayor. I have two questions. The first one relates to page 255 under property 2.1. My question is council able to effectively transfer that land, or does he treat it as being transferred, or is there any impediment to that? And secondly, have we taken that up with the state government? In other words, have we taken it up with a minister to have that sorted out, because I'm sure other councils in the state would be in the same order, and obviously if it should be in our name, it should be in our name. And I don't believe, if it's going from one name to, if you like, the community's name, that we should be paying stamp duty. No, it's on parcels of land that should be in council's name but remain listed in the owner of deregistered companies.
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, the impediment is the cost that we might have to pay. I'm not aware we've taken it up at a ministerial level, but certainly this is an issue that is faced by councils throughout Tasmania. There is a property working group, and this issue has been on their agenda, and we have looked to raise it through that forum with Legat, but certainly at this stage it does remain an impediment, the fact that we are levied stamp duty on parcels of land that are being transferred that rightly should be in council's name.
So on that, through you, Mayor, should that be an item that we take to the Legat annual conference?
Through you, Mayor, if it's not already been done so, I would suggest that we would welcome that.
Thank you. And another question, if I may, Mayor, and it's on page 268, 269, and I don't think it goes to 270. No. Is there any, or can we, where there's been an infringement and a fee paid, is there any reason why we can't put dollars and cents that has been collected?
Through you, Mayor, we do record statistics on our income. I guess one of the issues is in relation to unpaid infringements, where they are either in a situation where they're 30 days with us, or they've been handed to TAS Collection Services, or they've gone to the Mandatory Penalty Enforcement Unit. But certainly, yes, we do record income statistics, and if council was to provide an indication as to what sort of statistics you'd like to see, we can endeavour to provide them.
Through you again, Mayor. I was just hoping that maybe we could incorporate that into this report so there was a dollar figure beside each one where an infringement had occurred.
Yeah, I'd point out a lot of these aren't infringements. The way these statistics are recorded is when someone rings up, it's logged through our pathway system, and it may not result in an infringement. We do return a lot of dogs without an infringement being issued, We do investigate a lot of incidents, and the end result may be one of public education. It may be a warning. So these statistics aren't purely relating to number of infringements. They're relating more to the calls we received and the activities that are undertaken.
Thank you. I was referring to the infringements, but I'm easy either way. I just thought it might have been a good educational point.
Thank you, Mayor. Question about on page 269, proactive fire hazard requests. I note that they've gone from 1 to 38, and I assume that's because it's summertime, but can I have it explained to me about what are these proactive fire hazard requests? Thanks.
Yes, through you, Mayor. We, at the start of each fire season, i.e. in spring, we contact every property owner who has previously had either a notice on them or they are known to have a property that has previously been assessed as having a fire hazard. So they are sent a letter that outlines what their requirements are under the fire hazard abatement requirements.
Quick question. The land transfers from deregistered companies, how have we become entitled to those pieces of land?
Through you, Mayor, they relate to subdivisions for which there is a road reservation or road casement or public open space that at the time was never transferred to council. So they've historically remained in the name of the developer. And then that developer then becomes a deregistered company, and by rights it should be in council's name, but it's never happened.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Mayor's Communications is next. It's on page 271. Councillor Westwood, you look the same as I do. Very tired. Councillor Cordover.
I just need to find it, Mayor. It was about the Margate on the 3rd of December. Is there any information you'd like to divulge about Margate development?
The General Manager, Mr Arnold, talked about this in his GM's report because he was at the same meeting. So we went to see Mr Callis in town. The reason we went to see him to say what's going on, and we were sort of really happy with the positive response that he gave. He was enthusiastic about the project. He wanted to progress it. He wants to work with council to see it happen. We talked about the city deal funding broadly as well, and the need for park and ride at Margate, which is sort of a personal view, not council's necessarily yet. We also talked about bus infrastructure in Margate and how, because the bus stop is right outside where the development is, and I said to him, wouldn't it be good if we could develop a nice bus stop as part of your development there? And he was enthusiastic about that as well. I think the commitment he gave at the end was that he'd come to us early in this year with a next step or with an update. But he wasn't overly familiar with Kingborough Council. He thought I was the General Manager and Gary was the Mayor, and it was a good introductory meeting. Yeah. Famous. Any other lights are on, so we're going to move on. We now move to the minutes of the Kingborough Community Safety Committee, which is on page 273. Councillor Bastone.
Sorry, just in other business on page 277, comment was made that the committee identified the crossing from the car park towards Salamanca Fresh has been removed. I just wondered what's going to be done about it. Are you writing a letter to the Channel Court owners or what, because it's private land.
Councillor Westwood.
I did have some discussion about this and decided that probably wasn't much I could do about it, given it is private land. If you think it would be worthwhile to raise that, I certainly can, but I know we've had a number of discussions about that complex and the appetite to work constructively. So, there was some discussion that it had been removed, but nothing listed as an action item.
Councillor Midgley.
I'd just like to acknowledge it was great to see the voices of children, and well done, Councillor Westwood, for inviting the young voices that we don't actually get to hear very often, and hearing their safety concerns, and a lot of the things they raised actually were often raised by adults as well, so that's great to see. And just reading the minutes, it's interesting to note that there's a lot of safety matters related to barriers to participating in active transport. So there's a correlation, I think, between this committee and the KBAC as well.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, through you, Mayor. Just a question about... I'm now looking... Maybe I've gone too far ahead. I'm on page 278. Just wondering if there's been any commentary around why business burglary offences have gone up 360% and higher than the five-year average as well.
Happy for Councillor Westwood to chime in, but I had went and saw the inspector last Thursday and raised this with a bunch of other things, and his point was that because crime rates are so low in Kingborough, it doesn't take much for the stats to fly up. And one of the things, I think the other one is car burglaries, which they had one night where they had, I think, a dozen or so got broken into by one group. They're all unlocked cars, which blew his stats out for the year. So it's a good problem to have in that our crime rates are low to start with, and it just means we get these fluctuations every now and then. The meeting with the kids was great, and the difference... I mean, I think we made the right decision in merging these two committees. I sat on both of them, and the committee's working a lot better with the integration of the two, but the terms of reference are so broad, the committee could do a lot of things, but I think Councillor West was doing a good job in as the chair in setting the strategy or the vision for what they're doing, and having a focus on kids' safety, getting to school is a really good one for road safety. Those, I'm sure most of us have probably been to those meetings, and you can have a situation where you have community members coming with, you know, I'm not happy with the crossing at Margate, and nothing actually really happens, to be honest. There's a bit of a talk fest, but the focus from the chair has been good in that everyone's focusing on a couple of issues, which I think is much more productive, and the kids were great. It's just whether or not we can actually resolve some of the issues they raised. I know, though, that, for example, we know Kingston Primary has come up as part of our play scores thing, which is really great, and in fact the comments that a consultant made and the community made were the same as what the kids were making, which is great. Margate's not listed, but I know we're about to do some work at Margate Primary to improve pedestrian access or crossing there for the kids. And Illawarra, I think we're doing... No, St. Aloysius, we've done some work at Huntingfield as well as a result of an accident that was there. So the important thing is that they're getting actioned, and I think some good civics for the kids, but there was also some good feedback that we took on board, and Matthew Snow, our officer, was taking a lot of notes and seems to be working well. Councillor Grace.
You mentioned crossings. Are they council responsibility?
Pedestrian crossings? Oh, the for example, on Van Morey Road in Margate.
Not the Channel Highway.
Van Morey Road, we're doing an unmanned pedestrian crossing there just to direct the people, because they're parking at the hall and walking across. Should also acknowledge Renee Clark went and met with one of our engineers went and met with the school association there, and took down all the notes and came back to them with a plan which is almost exactly what they wanted, and it's been really well received, so it's great. Next item is, I haven't got any other lights, we're going to move on to the minutes of the Kimbra Bicycle Advisory Committee. Any comments or questions? Councillor Fox.
I did ask this question, but I suspect the person I asked was on leave, but we had a meeting on the 13th of December as well, and that hasn't been reported to this agenda. And in that particular meeting, we focused on budget items, which we'd like to have included in the budget. So I'm hoping that they'll still be... my question is, I guess, are they still going to make it to the budget sessions?
I think the answer is going to be yes, because we're not doing a workshop until March, so
yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah, okay, right. Yeah. Good. That's really what we've been focusing on.
Next week, yeah. Yep. Okay, there's no other lights on, and that's the last report. So the motion is moved by Councillor Westwood and seconded by Councillor Walsh is that the following information reports be noted. Financial report for 1 July to 31 December, Governance and Community Services Quarterly Report, Mayor's Communications, Minutes of the Kingborough Community Safety Committee, Minutes of the Kingborough Bicycle Advisory Committee. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against, motion is carried unanimously. For the record, Councillor Mitchell left the meeting at 8.53 and then returned at 8.54pm. Next item is the confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session. And the motion is that in accordance with Regulation 15 of the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulation 2015, Council by absolute majority move into closed session to consider the following items: confirmation of minutes, application for leave of absence, and current court matters. Someone like to move that? Moved by Councillor Minchley, seconded by Councillor Westwood. All those in favour, please say aye. Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. And in accordance with the Kingborough Council Meetings Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of this meeting will now cease. And